Good morning, everybody. Today is June 20th, and I'm joined by my colleagues, Commissioner Laura Dominguez and Commissioner David Richson. I believe Commissioner Alex Friend is on the way. This is the Land Use and Sustainability Committee meeting. Welcome to summer. Hopefully everyone's avoiding the foul weather we've had the last day or so. We've got some housekeeping items. Tom, do you want to tell us?
Sure. Two items have been withdrawn. Item number 8, which is the analysis of minimum parking requirements in the city, that has been withdrawn by the sponsor. And number 9, regarding identifying tangible incentives for private properties that are sustainable and resilient, that has also been withdrawn. So those two items will not be heard today. And then item number 5, regarding the requirement for a 6/7 vote of the commission prior to the adoption of any amendments to FAR requirements. The item sponsor, Commissioner Minor, corresponded with me this morning and said he would not be able to participate, but he would still like this item to move forward and for the committee to make a recommendation on this item.
Okay. So he's not going to be on today?
He won't be on today, no.
Okay. All right. He's got an item that I'm co-sponsoring, which is item number 11, and I believe I have some people here. So why don't we take that first? I'll tee it up. This is to discuss, I think, a very important item for a lot of homeowners and businesses here, particularly, you know, as we come into the summer months and hurricane season, the importance of potentially undergrounding a lot of our electrical lines. And so this is to discuss FPL's Storm Secure Underground Program and opportunities for identifying City of Miami Beach neighborhoods, which may be eligible for undergrounding of power lines through the program at no cost or expense to city residents or businesses. So I'm not sure who wants to kick this off.
I'll just do the introductory remarks, Mr. Chair. Joe Gomez, Public Works Director, thank you and good morning, Commissioners, and Deputy City Manager Eric Carpenter. You're absolutely correct. We've invited representatives from FPL to discuss the secure underground program from FPL. So with that, I think it's probably appropriate for Chris to take over and give us a brief presentation.
Thank you, Joe, and good morning, everyone. My name is Christopher Ferreira, and I'm an External Affairs Area Manager for Florida Power and Light here in the City of Miami Beach area. At FPL, we're working constantly, day in and day out, to deliver what's called America's best energy value, right? That's energy that's not just clean and affordable, but also reliable, right? And our reliability story really started about 20 years ago through our storm protection plan. We've been working on that to harden various parts of the grid, right, including areas here at Miami Beach. Starting with our transmission system, our feeder system, and what we're going to be talking about today is really our lateral system, which is a component of that overall system, right? It's really downstream from everything else, but no need to say it's still an important part, right? At this time, I'd like to call Eduardo Escudero, who's the engineering leader for this program, who will be able to walk you through a little bit more about what I was talking about earlier, and also give you some of the particulars on the program. So with that, I'll turn over to Eduardo.
Hi, good morning, everybody, commissioners and deputy city manager, Mr. Director. Thank you guys for having us here. We're excited to come and present our Storm Secure Underground program. So as my colleague Chris had mentioned, FPL is striving to build the strongest and most energy efficient grid in the United States. And we are taking many strides to make that happen. So one of the things that we hold in high regard is that we have been awarded the most reliable utility in the United States several years through a third-party investigation. And we have completed 100% of our transmission structures. We removed all of them. They are no longer wood. They are either concrete or steel. 77% of our main power lines have been hardened or undergrounded. Just under 50% of our distribution lines have also been undergrounded. We have implemented over 6 million smart meters, smart equipment, so that we can have faster contact with our meters. Over 200,000 intelligent devices, some that are self-healing and, really innovation when it comes to the grid system. And we still implement our continuous tree trimming activities, which vegetation is a high incident, shows high incident of outages. So that's something that we're still continuing going forward. So vegetation is the leading cause of the outages for overhead power lines. We saw and we all experienced that during the 2017 hurricane season with Hurricane Irma. There was a significant amount of down power lines because of this vegetation, these trees falling, and not just here in Dade County, but throughout all of our service territory. And that's really where the genesis of this program started. So as we were alluding to before, you can see in the image in front of you that the power plant is really where the generation happens. And then we have our transmission lines followed by our substations going to the feeder lines, which we're calling our main lines. And then down at the bottom of that diagram, you have the lateral lines. And those lateral lines are really what services the businesses and the residents. So the transmission lines we have hardened. We decommissioned the last wood transmission structure last year. So we have completed that portion, and we are substantially complete with our feeder section. The city of Miami Beach is still, I believe they have 20 feeder lines left out of a total of 50 that are still remaining to be feeder hardened. So our lateral program is near toward the end of this storm protection plan phase. This is a little more real-world pictures of what these lines may look like. On the far left, you have the transmission lines, which are the large structures that have the fatter wires. This moves high voltage from power generation to substation or substation to substation. In the middle, we have our main lines, which we call our feeder lines. And then from there, branch off the lateral lines to the individual residences or the businesses. So we have a criteria that we have submitted to the Public Service Commission for approval. And this is the performance during named storm events, outages due to vegetation, and performance during day-to-day operations. So it's all of these factors that go into the selection criteria for undergrounding these power lines. Our program is a little unique in the sense that we typically have a two-year life cycle. So the first year is the design and the outreach phase, followed by the construction year. So here in Dade County, we have partnered with MasTec company. So they do our design, our permitting, our outreach, and our construction for the entirety of the project. One of the things that we have felt that has been a positive through our program is our customer outreach personnel. They are the same throughout the life of the project. So these are the folks that are knocking on doors, talking to the residences, talking to the business owners, and advising them of what our program is about. They will have that continuity throughout the two-year process, and therefore, if there any questions arise, they know who to speak to. It's not like they're calling a random 1-800 number. So our process is we have, through the first year, we go through conceptual design, where we have engineers go out into the fields and start producing drawings and calculations based off of the most efficient route that we have for our engineering, followed by the final design, which then conclude with the permitting process that can carry over into the next year. And then we would move on with construction in the following year. This is just to show how much we do communicate with the members of the public. We send out letters before we even make phone calls, and we make phone calls before we knock on doors so that they know that we're coming in advance. There are several letters that come throughout the course of the project advising them even, hey, this is a program. You may have seen us we are starting construction and then going into completing construction. So we maintain that communication throughout the typical two-year lifespan of the project. We have, as I mentioned, we do have vendors that work for us throughout the entire service territory. However, they are required to wear FPL branded clothing. They wear typical things that you would see is they would wear a baseball cap with a polo shirt, talking about FPL, Storm Secure Underground Program. They would have a safety vest. They would often move forward with a laptop, and they would also have a badge that identifies them as FPL contractors. So we have seen in the news where you know, folks would be trying to impersonate other companies, so we are avoiding that by giving them the branded equipment. This is an image of what you may typically see during our projects. So on the left-hand side, you have a before image. You can see on the pole, the cylinder there, that's an overhead transformer. And then the line that goes to the house there, that would be the overhead electrical wire going into the weatherhead of the property down into the meter. After we go through our project, this would be a typical scenario on the right-hand side where the pole that was there before that had the transformer has the transformer removed, the pole is topped off, and the overhead wire is also removed. Now, you see a little bit of differentiation there on the side of the house. The weather head is cut off. It's filled with the foam, and it's capped so that nothing gets in or gets out. We do add a junction box, which is that rectangular box to the right of the meter, and that is where we make our connection to the customer service. The pad-mounted transformer here, this isn't something that every property would get. It typically runs, depending on the size of the homes and how far they are away from the equipment, but we're seeing an average of about every five properties that a transformer would have to be placed. So if you have a transformer in your backyard, that doesn't mean you're getting one in your front. We're kind of reimagining the grid here. And this equipment, these are more real-life pictures of what you would see. The transformer is the green box on the left. They average about 3 by 3.5 feet. The way that we place this is by a private easement where we would reach out to the customer, have meetings with them so that they understand the benefits of the program, and we request a 10-by-10 easement from them. So as they grant that for us, that is of their, you know, their choice to participate into the program. In the middle, you have on the left-hand side, you have the longer gray box. That is our junction box where we would make the connections inside of there. And then on the right-hand side is a handhole where we would often split service to different properties. Another thing that is highly beneficial to our program is our main construction method. It's almost our exclusive construction method is horizontal directional drilling. So that is a huge benefit to the experience of the homeowner, as we don't tear up their yard or tear up their driveway. We directionally bore underneath their property, and we would pop up at the base of the meter so that we can tie directly into that junction box as we showed before. This is also the method for construction in right-of-way. So we do have our primary line that goes through right-of-way, so we would be directionally boring from, you know, point A to point B, avoid damaging the sidewalk, avoid closures to roadways. So it's a least invasive construction method, and you know, we've seen a lot of benefit from it. Another tool that we employ is an augmented reality tool. So as I mentioned, our customer outreach specialists, they do walk around with iPads, and in there we have programs that will allow them to show the homeowner where either the transformer or the junction box is going to be on their property, as well as what it looks like. So this is a pretty close representation to scale as to what their property would look like after the fact. This is the plan that we have for the SSUP program. So as you can see, you know, we are ramping up in our efforts throughout our entire service territory to kind of plateau and move forward in the year 2027. So we started out as a pilot, and we just became a full-fledged program a little over a year ago. And so now we have the support of the Public Service Commission, and as we are part of the Storm Protection Plan, this is a program that is now official within FPL and a commitment that we have with our customers.
Just a question, I'm sure you'll get to it, but maybe the punchline is, you know, where is Miami Beach in this plan?
So Miami Beach, right now, we plan out every 2 years in advance. So they are not on our current 2-year plan. We reassess regularly where the reliability is. So as I mentioned before, the selection process is based off of those three main criteria: the performance during named storms, their performance day to day, and their performance during vegetation outages. So as we continually reassess, the placement of the feeders, and I should have described that. I apologize. So what we do is we select a feeder, the worst performing feeders in our service territories, and those are the feeders that have the laterals that we're going to be undergrounding.
So Miami Beach is not in your plan?
Our plan is to underground the entire service territory, including Miami Beach. Now, some of the things that are happening in Miami Beach right now is that our feeder hardening program is still going to be continuing to work here. The goal is to complete that program by 2025. That is a separate program from us, but we are part of the storm protection plan.
I mean, the reason I think myself and Commissioner Minor and some others wanted to talk about this is to find out where we're at with respect to your plans to, you know, potentially underground some of these utility lines to further harden our city and make us more resilient. And then to the extent that, you know, maybe we're not in your plans, how do we get on your plans and or engage third-party consultants who can help us, navigate this?
Yes. So, Commissioner, the way that it comes down to the selection process that was approved by the Public Service Commission, and it comes down to those three performance metrics. And as Miami Beach comes into those performance metrics, then they will be selected for the program. So we can accelerate through our program. There are other programs that FPL does have, the overhead to underground conversion program, that does allow for that to happen. However, that is a city-driven program.
I mean, it just seems to me, as a regulated entity that FPL is, and then the Public Service Commission, which is, a political body, that, to some extent, to what extent does, lobbying and relationships help that process to get your city, in the queue or, in the priority line? It just seems to me that this is, ripe for that kind of, influence to try to get, a city that's covered by a state representative or someone, next in line for this, benefit. So, question maybe for our city staff, one is, do we put this as part of our legislative priority to go lobby the PSC, or we engage a third-party consultant to help us navigate this, identify grants, identify opportunities to try to get us. Because I think if we leave it to ourselves, we're going to be outdone by cities that are actively, seeking to influence this process.
So if I can just jump in real quick, right?
Okay.
Because I want to emphasize a point that Eduardo mentioned, right? The program is geared specifically by reliability data, right? That's what the three criteria that he mentioned cover. The idea behind the program is to address the worst performing laterals in our system, right? On a feeder basis, right? So I know it's a little confusing. The laterals tie into the feeder, but the idea is to address the worst performing lines in our system first. So the fact that Miami Beach does not have any lines within the program in the next 2-3 year horizon, it should be good news, right? The reliability in this area, the reliability of these lines is actually better than other parts of our territory. And I want to be absolutely clear is that there's no opportunity to influence through a third-party consultant our process, right? As a regular utility, as you mentioned, we do have to provide this information to the Florida Public Service Commission, and there is no opportunity for us to accelerate a particular city over another one, right? And the last thing I just want to mention is, I know there's been some news in the local papers, in the local media, regarding a particular city and a project that we have in that city, but the lines don't get selected based on cities, right? They get based on, again, back to the reliability data, back to our lines. Our lines do not follow city boundaries. Sometimes they cross in and out. And just because we have a project in that city does not mean that the whole city is getting addressed at one time either, right? They're getting addressed based on the line. So I just want to make sure that I clarify all those points to make sure that we're conveying the purpose of the program and the way the program is operating correctly.
Ed Laura was good.
Thank you both for the presentation. I had a couple of quick questions. I think with the item here on the agenda that Vice Mayor Areola and Commissioner Minor put forth, they were specifically looking at secure undergrounding. And if I understood from Eduardo's presentation and our conversation, Chris, your program is to harden an underground, so not necessarily a utility line is going to go underground. It could just be reinforced. And so, it was mentioned that 77% has already been hardened or undergrounded. How many is it just undergrounded?
So what I mentioned was for the feeders, those are the main lines. I don't have the numbers in front of me, so I wouldn't want to speak out of turn. But of that group that is hardened or undergrounded, I believe it's a little more than half of those that are already done. And that's for the feeder, so that's a separate program. So we typically come after that program is complete. So one of the items that we try to emphasize is we're not going to come in. We still have to come from an overhead main line to go underground. So it would be a waste of resources to replace a pole so that we can do our job, and then the feeder hardening group now comes and has to disrupt service again so that they can replace a newly replaced pole. So we typically follow that, you know, once they're complete. As, you know, I showed in that diagram, we're down at the end of the line of the reinforcement process, right, the hardening process. So hardened, to answer your question, hardened also it means both, right? It means our lines are undergrounded, and also means our poles and lines are also more resilient.
I just want to make sure that we're specific, because if – the city is looking to get as many lines undergrounded as possible, that if something is hardened but is staying above ground, that it's clearly communicated to the residents of that neighborhood, because then their expectation could be, well, why are the poles still up when maybe they're perfectly safe, but they might have been thinking that it was going underground. Thanks.
Absolutely. And if I can just add as well, once we do come in underground in a neighborhood, and specifically the lateral, right, which is a great point that you brought up, the feeders is going to stay above ground. The lateral, which comes off of it, goes underground. The telecommunication, cable, internet providers that are also attached to the poles are also going to remain above ground unless those providers elect to go underground or relocate somewhere else off of the pole, right? So that's another distinction between the conversion process, which the city, I believe, is very familiar with, because there's been several projects that have taken place in specific neighborhoods to underground entire neighborhoods, right? Feeders, laterals, telephone cables, internet, et cetera. And our program, which is specifically intended for the electrical infrastructure and only for that particular lateral line that comes off of that feeder.
I just have a couple more slides that can finish.
Yep. Do you have anything?
So can we just go back, and I've got some other questions, but I just want to get back to the performance. Can you just walk me through the three performance metrics?
Yeah, I'll put them back on screen.
Thanks.
So it's the performance during named storm events.
Okay.
The outages of power lines due to vegetation outages, and performance of day-to-day, so, you know, blue sky operations as well.
What was the third one?
Day-to-day operations, so on a regular day like today, where we don't have a storm event, and, you know, we don't have a wind event that's affecting vegetation.
So you're taking some sort of data that you have collected over some period of time on these three different areas?
Yes. So we collect data on a daily basis, on a regular basis, for all of our metrics. So comes a time of a stormed event, that's like a snapshot for that event. So we see how the lines perform there. And then there's we get notified when we have, through some of that smart equipment that I had mentioned, we can identify when we have vegetation outages, or sometimes you can go out in the field and, you know, a branch is on there. And then we also record our data on day-to-day operations as well. So all of that factors into the performance metrics for our selection criteria.
And are those three performance metrics, are those memorialized in state law, or is this just something FPNL came up with? Or
yeah, so this is part of the approved criteria with the Public Service Commission.
Okay, so you went to the PCS and you said, this is how we want to implement, and these are the criteria that we're going to use.
Correct, and they subsequently approved that process.
Okay. So it seems to me what's missing is a consideration of the location and geography. I mean, we're a barrier island, right? So if we're going to have a storm and the storm is coming over the water, we could be the first to be hit, right? So, and I'm just wondering why that wasn't considered.
Well, that's why we worked with the state, and the state, you know, we went, it was a process, you know, to get this approved. So this is the criteria that the state approved, you know, with these three main metric points.
If I can just jump in, I mean, yeah. I think our approach is data specific, right? And that's thanks to, we have this data thanks to the investments we've made in the grid, right? All of our smart technology. Every single one of our homes has a smart meter attached to it that's recording data when power goes off, when power goes on. Most people don't even know that you don't have to call us anymore to report an outage, right? Most times we already know that the power's out, and by the time you call in, a ticket's been created, a crew's en route, and the problem's getting resolved even before you found out or as you're finding out, right? And so this data that's collected on the smart grid on a daily basis, like Eduardo mentioned, is a resource that we have to look at where are the worst performing lines, right? And not have any sort of specific metrics that may be based on, you know, that may be looked at to say, hey, is there a bias here, a bias there? It's all scientific. It's all data-driven to determine which are the worst performing lines, which are our customers that have the worst service, to then address those lines, put them underground, and see the improvement. And the pilot, that was the whole intention behind the three-year pilot that was approved back in 2018, was let's test out this program and see if it does result in an improvement. And in one of Eduardo's later slides, he mentions that there's a 50% improvement in reliability on those worst performing lines, right? And so that was like a case study to show, you know, that this program could work efficiently and effectively to address this issue for our customers.
Yeah, but what I think's missing is you're talking about performance of the line during a non-storm event for the most part. And so what we're trying to address is we're a barrier island. Mm-hmm. And so why wasn't there any consideration about the basic geography, right? So, I mean, we're not worried about an ordinary, you know, day. We're worried about the vulnerability when a storm is coming over the water, right? And we could be, barrier islands typically tend to be riskier than the mainland. So, but it doesn't sound like there was any consideration given to that.
So, Commissioner Richardson, so one of the metrics, if I don't know if it can be put back on the screen, is the performance during the storm. So that is a main factor in where we are, right? So we all experience the storm events. The areas that are hit harder, they do get more. More weight.
So how is that, would that be, so for example, if there's a storm on the West Coast, would we be evaluated because the state of Florida is undergoing a storm period, or is it only performance when a storm hits our area?
It's a performance during, so when the storm is named and it starts to affect the service territory, that's where the snapshot starts. So overall. Part of the improvements that we've had through this storm protection plan, so all of the other projects that we've had, prior to the 2017 storm season, our one-day restoration times were about 4%, 5% of the public was restored in one day. After the storm, the feeder hardening group has substantially completed and we started our program, we have about 51% day one restoration during Hurricane Irma, and even during Hurricane Ian, we have 61% of the residents were restored on the first day. So overall, we have to look at this as a bigger picture. Overall, we are seeing substantial improvement, and this is now the last steps that we're seeing as part of the storm protection plan with our program.
Which storm, though, I'm trying to think about, what was it, and maybe 14 or 15 that hit Miami Beach really hard. And I may be off on my dates, but I remember we had, was it?
So Irma was in 17.
So, because I remember my power was out for 6 days. And I was lucky enough to go stay in a hotel. Not every one of our residents would be in a position to do that.
Yeah.
And so you're saying that performance of 6-day outage, some people had their power out for 10 days. You're saying that was considered in
Yes, sir. In yes. This? So all of that is considered, right, in the data that is during named events. So that is part of our selection criteria.
Well, how would you consider 10 days of power outage to be good performance or bad performance or average performance?
Well, the goal is to always have, you know, no outages during the storm. You know, the storm is something that we can't control. What we can do is put in these measures. You know, here at the beach, I know we have stainless steel transformers, which is something that is a direct effect as to our geographic location. Our poles are more resilient. Our lines are bigger because of where we are, right? So that's part of the process that we do as part of the storm protection plan. And, you know, we are seeing the benefits here in Miami Beach. Now, unfortunately, you know, like in your specific case and in the case of the residents that you mentioned, that is not the rule. It's the exception. You know, myself, I still haven't had benefit of this program personally as well. So I'm looking forward as to when it comes down to me as well. But that's just because it's a data driven, just based off of the performance of these three metrics that we mentioned.
And are these performance metrics public information so that if we wanted to see where we rank, or do we have access to that, or is it protected information?
I don't have the answer to that. I do know that you can have access to the city's information, I believe. I don't know. I think that's...
Well, we file it with the Florida Public Service Commission. So there is a filing that gets submitted to them. What is it, on a 3-year basis?
Yes, and it has a list of the projects that were...
But does it show the ranking of where Miami Beach is in the order of service areas that are being prioritized?
I don't have that information.
It would just show what's in the next 3 years, right? What's in the next phase of the program? But if I can just go back for a second, right, and address your concern regarding the restoration time during Irma, right? Similar to how we described how the grid has been hardened, right, the storm protection plan, is similar to how we restore power after a storm, right? We start upstream at the power plants, right, ensure that they're back online. If they never went offline, great. The transmission system needs to be operational for it to deliver the power to the substations, to then deliver the power to the feeders, to then deliver the power to the laterals, right? And then after the laterals, you may have cases or instances where there may be a building or a home that may not be restored because of damage to either equipment on their end or equipment that directly services them, right? But we aim to restore the largest number of customers in the quickest amount of time, right? And so I don't know the specifics of your case in Hurricane Irma, right? But it could very well be that we did restore power to the area, and for whatever reason, your block or your building had another issue that required it additional work that had to get done at a later time frame, right? And so that's really similar to how we are hardening the system. That's how we restore power. And as Eduardo mentioned, there's not just one criteria, which is day-to-day operations, right? We look at three different sets of criteria, right? It's the storms, the named storms, which are hurricanes, right? And I believe that's over, what, a 10-year period?
Right now, it's starting, I think, with Matthew. I believe Matthew and the one right before Matthew.
Right.
The name escapes me.
Then we have the day-to-day vegetation issues, right? Outages that occur outside of a named storm that are related to vegetation. And remember, the intent of this program originally was, let's look at that vegetation. A lot of these laterals typically run in the rear of homes, right, where it's difficult to get access to maintain trees and other external factors away from our infrastructure, right? And the last piece was to look at the day-to-day operations. And so to go back to your original question about geography and location, I would say that that is taken into account in the reliability data, right? If the reliability data that we're getting off of our smart grid is telling us that reliability is good in this area, that factor geography should be taken into account, right? Anything that's happening in this area that would be exposed to the system more than other areas, correct? So I think the data is the best way, or the company, you know, we feel that the data is the best way to identify which are the worst performing lines. And again, provide a better service to our customers that are on the worst end of the service first, and then work our way, like I said, where Eduardo mentioned, the entire service story is in this program. So we are going to continue working on this program and address the laterals system-wide, but, you know, address those that have the worst reliability first and then work our way down.
So, well, first of all, let's say that it wasn't just me. There were a lot of residents that didn't have power for a long period of time, and I wasn't concerned about me. I was more worried about getting senior buildings restored, and you guys, to your credit, prioritize those where you have large groups of people, and I appreciate that. How do we find out where we rank? If there are, you know, 300 cities or 300 geographic areas, however you defined them, how can we learn where we rank in your list of priorities so that we would have a feeling if we're midway down the list, if we're all the way down the list, you know?
The answer is going to be you're probably spread out throughout the whole list because, again, I want to reiterate, it's not based on cities or geographical area, right? The lines are based on an individual basis, right? So there may be a line that's scheduled for, I don't know, you know, 5 years out or is showing us it'd be 5 years out.
Yeah.
There may be, you know, another two or three lines that are 10 years out. It's all throughout this program, right? The same way that we've been working to harden the system, the transmission and feeder system, right? And it took us 20 years, right? This storm protection plan, let me just back up for a second. The storm protection plan was put into place back in 2006 after the 2004-05 storm season, right, which was a historic storm seasons for the state of Florida where we got, I don't even know how many storms it was. I don't recall the exact number, but there was storms crisscrossing the entire state, right? And so after that, those two storm seasons, it was a decision made, and it was ultimately approved by the Florida Public Service Commission to implement a storm protection plan to invest in removing wood poles from our transmission system, to upgrade older wooden and concrete poles in the feeder system. And that process took us, I mean, we're still not done, right? We just finished the transmission side of it last year, but the feeder side, we still have 2 more years to go, right? So this lateral hardening program, if I can call it that, right, that's really what the official name is. It's a lateral hardening program. You know, it's just getting started. It's the next iteration of that plan, and it's going to take us, you know, 20 or 30 years to complete the entire state. And so to answer your question, there's going to be lines all over the time frame in terms of where Miami Beach falls, right? The same for every other city. It's not like one city is getting something preferential over the other.
If I can add one thing there. So the substation, which is the image, I don't know if you can see the presentation. The substation has several feeder lines per substation. So we look at those on a feeder line basis, and then the worst performing feeder lines, that's how we get that's how they get selected based off of that criteria. So we don't – we wouldn't say, you know, City X has three or four of these, so we're going to do the whole city. So it's based off of that individual feeder line. So as Chris was mentioning, one may be at the very top of the list, and the next one may be at the very bottom of that list. But that's not to say that's how.
So let me. I'll just ask one more, and then I know others have questions. But how many performance areas, how many of these geographic areas, since they're not specific to cities, how many different areas touch Miami Beach? Is it 3 or 4 or 10 or 2?
I don't think I understand the question.
So you don't prioritize based on city. I understand
right.
That you prioritize based on some geographic area.
Yes.
So I want to know how many geographic areas overlap with the city of Miami Beach. Is it 10 different areas? Is it 2? Is it 3?
So it's based off. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No,
it's based off of the substation. So the substation can have like 4 or 5 or whatever number of main lines. So it's whatever that main line covers. That can be as small as 500 residents, or it can be as much as a couple thousand residents per main line.
But if I'm looking at the list of top priority to low priority. And I don't know how many is on the list, 1,000, 2,000 different geographic areas. How many of those geographic areas would be in Miami Beach? Is it 100? Is it 5? Is it 10? Any idea?
So if I can answer your question, I think you're referring to lines, right? The number of lines.
No, you said you prioritize based on a geographic area. You said you don't prioritize like city by city. You're not prioritizing or scoring Miami Beach. You're prioritizing a geographic area. It could overlap with two or three different cities, right?
No, we don't prioritize by geographic area. We prioritize, or we select the criteria determines which lines go based on the line's performance, right? So to answer your question, there are thousands of lines, as Eduardo showed in a graph there. We're literally looking to do 1,500 lines a year by 2027, right? We're starting in 2027. So there are literally thousands of lines throughout the entire state of Florida. To your question of how many of those are in Miami Beach, I don't know that right now off the top of my head.
But you could get that for us, right? What I'm trying to get to is there could be 1,000 lines. So if I look at the list of top priority to low, there could be 20 or 30 or 50 or 100, I don't know how many, in Miami Beach. And I just find it odd that not even one of those has been prioritized. It seems odd.
I will go back to this not being prioritized, right? We're working to address all the lines, right?
No, I understand, but they're ranked, right? They're ranked
based on reliability data.
Where you consider it to be the biggest risk,
right?
And right now, not one area within Miami Beach has achieved a level on the list so that it would be part of a work plan.
But I go back to it's not based on risk, right? It's based on reliability data, right? What's the performance, right?
I get it, but I just find it odd that I don't know how many we're talking about. I don't know if we're talking about 100 different line items on your schedule, your matrix, because it doesn't sound like that's public information. Or did you give the entire list to the Public Service Commission?
No, that data changes. It changes, you know, frequently.
But when the Public Service Commission approved your plan, did you give them the list of everything in the state of Florida? It might be 10,000 different scorings?
Yeah, so we can't provide that information because it's dynamic. So as soon as we create that data based off of if you have a rain event come by, that data can change. Or if you have a storm event, that data can change again. Even day-to-day operations, which is one of our metrics, that data.
So what changes. You gave to the Public Service Commission was your list of what you are prioritizing.
Based off of the data.
But you didn't give them the rest of what you're not prioritizing. You didn't give them the score for what you're not prioritizing.
I wouldn't use the term prioritizing or not. It's just the what the data is telling us, that is what we are working on.
No, but I'm just trying to, and I know others have questions, I'm just trying to find out where we rank. You know, if there are 20 different lines in Miami Beach, because you don't score the city as a whole, I'm trying to figure out where we sit in the ranking. Do we sit in the middle of the bunch? Do we sit? Clearly, we're not on the top because we're not in the work plan. But I'm just trying to figure out where we sit.
So I think to answer the question is we don't know. We'll have to go back and find out that's information that we can share or not. Okay. But the answer, I think, is we don't know.
Yeah, I have the same line of questioning Commissioner Richardson does, which is, you know, it would be very helpful to understand, you know, where the city of Miami Beach, just like any other municipality would like to know, where they stand, you know, Surfside, any coastal community. Because otherwise, this is a black box that you guys control. Don't know what kind of visibility the public or city has into where they fit into that mystery formula you have, since it's your data and you can manipulate it and cut it any way you want. So without proper visibility, this is a shell game, because you come up before every city and you say, oh, you're not in our list of priorities because there's a bunch of cities ahead of you based on our formula. Since we can't see it, we just have to take your word for it. I'm not comfortable with that. So let me ask you this. In your next 2 years in that priority list, what cities are in that list? Can we see that?
That is filed with the state. That's filed with the Public Service.
Do you have that here today?
I don't have it here today, but it is public information.
I'd like to see that list. I'm curious which cities are there, and I think, you know, I'd like to see, does it pass the sniff test, right? Because I'd be very curious if they're not coastal cities, for example, there, or are there cities that have very low populations or that sit in districts where they have very powerful state representatives, or where there might be some heavy new development going on where developers have a lot of influence, etc. Just curious.
Again, I just want to...
It would not be the first time something like that would happen. So I'm just curious. It's important that the public have confidence when they're being presented by the largest employer in the state, the most powerful company in the state, with the most lobbyists, with the most political donations, that have a monopoly that's regulated, that we have full confidence that what you're telling us passes the sniff test. Because right now you're saying you don't have data to satisfy our line of inquiry, and then you say, well, the data is changing all the time, so it makes it virtually impossible to understand, okay, we're 5 years out before we're next in queue, because the data gets shifted. That data is controlled by you, as are the definitions. So it's like a shell game, because you can always get cities to calm down, saying, well, you know, you're coming up. Well, last storm season, there was a bunch of other cities that jumped you in the queue because, you know, they had different issues. And like, we have no way of protecting ourselves.
So I need to address some of the things that you said. You know, we are a regulated utility, right? We respond to regulators at the Florida Public Service Commission. This is a program.
Yeah, Public Service Commission are appointed by the governor, I believe.
I believe they're appointed right. by the governor and confirmed by the legislature.
And the governor receives contributions, including by FPL and related lobbyists and friends. And then we know how the game is played. I mean,
I did not come to speak about. I'm not prepared to talk about.
Yeah, but I mean, don't say that
the political process
there's this PCS up there that's an independent agency. There's that's not true.
To continue addressing some of the points that you brought up. What Eduardo was referring to, and I believe that this is what he was saying when he says that the data is changing, right? When we provide a filing to the Florida Public Service Commission, we provide a filing based on the data that's available at that time period, right? What he's trying to refer to as that it's changing is that data could change moving forward into the future beyond the 2 or 3 year horizon that we're currently working on, right? And so any information that's beyond these 2 or 3 years could change given if there's a storm that impacts one particular area of the state or another, or if reliability goes down in a particular state of the area. That's what he was referring to.
I think you all have asked some great questions, Mr. Chair, colleagues. I'm interested in some of the information that you all have requested as to the lines and the ranking of the lines here in Miami Beach, because from my perspective, I want to see that and quantify it with customer served. You know, a line running through Miami Beach might not be the same amount of impacting the same amount of density or impacting the same amount of economic impact as it may in other parts of your service areas, it may in other parts of Miami-Dade County or out west. So I'd be interested in just knowing a little bit more about those lines, if it's not in a public setting, then in a private setting, so that we can somehow just quantify that and better advocate for ourselves. I'm just wondering, is there any action that's required with this item today?
I don't know that there's any specific action that went along with this particular item, but I think it is an ongoing conversation that we want to keep having with FPL. Obviously, I think that some of the questions have been good ones as to trying to determine where Miami Beach falls in the list so that we have a better understanding of when we would be eligible to participate. Right. Obviously, one of the things that we want to understand better, I think that you mentioned it earlier in the conversation, is that we have 50 feeders in the city. Are the areas directly related to those 50 feeders that are in the hardening process, or are there more areas in the city beyond those 50 feeders?
Can you clarify the question? I don't understand.
So earlier in the conversation, you had mentioned that all the transmission lines are done. You have 50 feeders within the city of Miami Beach, of which 20 are remaining to be hardened. I'm assuming that means that 50 is the entirety of the universe of feeders in Miami Beach.
Yeah, so that number is with a different program, but that's the information that I understand as well. that you have 50 overhead feeders, 20 of which have been hardened so far.
So that means that there would be 50 different Miami Beach-related lines in this overall.
It would be one line. Yes, one line would be each feeder. So, you know, if the 40th Street feeder one, you know, the number escapes me, but that would be one of the projects that we would call that would break up into multiple projects.
So of the thousands that would be across the state, approximately 50 of them would be within the city of Miami Beach.
Depending on how many lines come out of those.
Not necessarily. So the feeders are not laterals, right? The laterals come off of the feeders, right? So there could be multiple laterals on a feeder. But I think the point that you're trying to get to is that we need to complete the hardening process, right? Because the hardening process for the feeder lines, it was ultimately going to then benefit the laterals that one day will be underground, right? If the feeder's not hardened, that really defeats the whole intent of the storm protection plan.
No, that wasn't my question. I'm trying to get to the understanding that I think the commissioners were about how many different lines do we have in the overall line item budget that we look at every year to determine what gets funded and what doesn't in the next two-year program.
We can provide that number of lines that you have. That's something that we can make a note.
You can.
We can.
You can.
Yeah. We can tell you how many lines you have. Sure.
Okay. Well, with all due respect, it took us 20 minutes to get to that.
Let me ask you.
What was the question?
Commissioner.
How many feeders that we have in the Miami Beach area? That information we can provide.
Commissioner Fernandez, I think you're asking, you know, what are we trying to do with this item? You know, one of the things that
it's a great item, by the way.
Huh?
Yeah, it's a great item. Thank you for.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think there's a lot of folks here in our city, a strong majority would love to see, you know, our power lines and cable and other utilities undergrounded, not just for visual purposes, but just for safety purposes, the hardening of our cities. I mean, when these things, you know, a tree falls or, you know, there's a car accident that hits a pole or anything, you know, you can be out for quite a while. So the question is, okay, how do we address that? How do we work with FP&L to underground these things? How do we get ourselves in queue? The presentation today doesn't give me a lot of comfort that we're really at the mercy of FP&L based on a formula that seems to me to be somewhat of a black box and a shuffle game. And, you know, we're at their mercy, and I don't like that. I don't envy the role you guys are playing today to have to go and, you know, be the mouthpieces for your company. But, you know, we are elected officials, and we have to address the concerns of our residents. And so, you know, we're trying to work with a regulated utility and getting ourselves in a queue sooner rather than later so that we can further harden our city, make it more resilient. We are a barrier island, you know, heaven forbid a storm comes, you know, we could be in a world of hurt where we're out for weeks at a time just simply because we weren't pushing hard enough to work with FP&L to find solutions here. So I haven't heard anything today that gives me a lot of comfort that we're going to see anything anytime soon. Your process to me is obscure and completely controlled by you. Whether or not it goes to the PSC for approval doesn't give me any better comfort. So what my ask, and, you know, I'll call Joe up here perhaps, is, you know, I know that we work with various engineers and consulting firms, one of which is Stantec, which is on, we already have relationships with. You know, is it worthwhile to engage with a consultant to help us navigate this Byzantine, you know, labyrinth that we have before us? We know that the city of Coral Gables was potentially successful in getting their city to be in queue for undergrounding. You know, can we work with a company like Stantec to try to get someone to lobby on our behalf and take a look under the hood and try to get us in a good position here?
Mr. Chair, yes. And I did speak to Stantec, had a long conversation with them regarding how they worked the program with the City of Coral Gables. They were originally retained for the City of Coral Gables overall undergrounding program. And that was a program that I think started about a decade ago. And because of the cost of that program, the city of Coral Gables elected not to go into that route. But then the SSUP program was developed, and that Stantec was still retained by the city to act as a go-between between FPL and the city of Coral Gables. And yes, they're on our rotation of consultants. So I
want to get to the data, and unless you tell me that we don't have a right to see it, I want to try to figure out. It doesn't sound like you have that information with you today, but you can come back and present to us how many lines we have that cross over into the city and where, how they are ranked. Is that, you have that information, right?
We don't, you're right, we don't have it today. We can go back and see, if that's something we can provide to the city. I want to specifically talk to, you know, the process by which Coral Gables went through, right, for their let's say how they explored options for undergrounding, right? And I just want to reiterate that the same options that Coral Gables had, you know, whatever it was 10 years ago, 5 years ago, are the same options that the city of Miami Beach has today, right? You are in the storm secure underground program, the lateral hardening program, as it's also known by, and allow that program to work on these lines and address them in the future. Or there's the overhead to underground conversion process or program as well. That is an option that the city has as well to explore, which is we provide an estimate. There is a cost adjustment based on the system going underground as provided as part of that estimate, and you can elect to move forward with it, and that does address, or the city has the option to address, you know, whether it's a lateral, whether it's a feeder, and then as part of that program, you also have to address the communication third parties are attached to it. And like I mentioned earlier in the presentation, there are several neighborhoods within the city that have already participate in that program or ongoing in that program right now or are in construction.
So, for example, I think Palm and Hibiscus, when they did their construction, they elected to do that, and they paid for that, right?
Right.
Or did, I don't know, did we,
well, we provide
did the
an
residents
estimate.
Pay for it, or did we share, residents. Did the city, the residents paid for yes. it, I think, yeah.
We provide a cost, and including that cost to do that service to underground that infrastructure, there is an adjustment made to that cost, right? To realize the conversion from underground to from overhead to underground as part of that process, right? And that program as well is also part of our PSC tariff, so something that's also regulated, and we provide estimates all the time for different cities that want to explore that option, right? And again, that program is open to looking at not just laterals and feeders, right? Where the SSUP is only focused on the laterals.
But I think the chair's point, and I share the view, is this ranking doesn't seem very transparent in that we don't know where we sit right now. And so as elected officials representing the residents, knowing that we're a barrier island, I want to know how we're ranked.
So we can go back and explore the option of providing that information, right? Based on the current data. But I think what Eduardo was trying to emphasize earlier and the point that he was making that I think maybe wasn't elaborate enough upon, right, is that when you're looking, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years out, none of us know what's going to happen, right? I don't have a crystal ball that I can tell you, you know, there'll be a storm next
that.
Year
but,
or a storm the following year, right?
You know today, it's a snapshot in time.
Mm-hmm.
When you submitted your ranking to the PSC to get approval, you took a snapshot in time, right? And then
exactly. That's the point I'm
so
trying to make. That
I'm
took.
Saying in the snapshot,
mm-hmm.
I want to see where we ranked in the snapshot. I understand it's going to change tomorrow because you've got some data collection on my meter and so forth, and that's fine. But in the snapshot, when you went to the PSC and said, this is what we want to prioritize because the performance risks are showing us that that's what we should do. I want to see where we ranked at that point in time.
I understand the request. We're going to explore it, but I just want to finish the point that it's not that it's a moving target, right? Moving the future. It's just things happen on a daily basis on our system, yeah. Whether it's trees, whether it's a storm, that's going to affect that data moving forward, right?
I understand.
And so your point is exactly what I was trying to convey, which is it's a snapshot in time
yeah.
that has to be taken in order to make a decision to put projects into construction. And that's why there's a ongoing cycle of us taking those snapshots, right, as time progresses to then make the best decision possible when that happens. So it could be very well that, you know, if we're able to provide that data in terms of where my reach, the lines fall, that today it may say that there's one that's 5 years from now. But in 2 or 3 years, it may move up or down the list.
I understand. How often do you go to the PSC? Is it like every year you go and update the list?
We file with them every year for like a two-year look ahead.
For how many years?
For the two-year cycle.
Yeah.
So we advise them as to which projects we're going to be doing.
So every year you're filing. And what month of the year do you file that?
I couldn't say. I'm not the one that manages okay. the filing of that.
So, Chairman, can we bring this back maybe next month? And do you think that you could come back next month and tell us when you did your last filing and based on that snapshot where we were ranked in terms of all the different lines in Miami Beach? So we need to know when you file, how many lines cross over into Miami Beach. Is it 100? Is it 1,000? And where we rank. Those three things, that's what I would like to know.
I don't know that we'll be ready for next month, but what I can say is that we can circle back when we have an answer to those questions and provide an update to you.
Maybe, Joe, you could liaison with them. And,
yes, sir.
And then see when they're
okay. Yeah, I mean, I would add to that, I'd just like to see who is next in queue. You said you budget these things 2 years out. So what are those other cities, municipalities? Who are they? You know, I'd like to understand that.
And that, well. I think you said, is a public filing with the PSC.
That we can provide you, yeah.
You could get us that today, right? Because that was the filing you've already done.
I have to reach out to the teams that work on that. I'm not the one.
Yeah, but I mean, you're not going to have to create it. You filed it with the PSC, so.
Public record.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could just send Joe a copy of that. It's a public record.
Yeah, and then in addition, in the meantime, though, you know, I'm worried about, you know, the stalling effect that ends up happening. You know, I'd like to set in motion whereby we would engage Stantec to start looking at this, because we're going to go into some recess, and then a few of us are going to term out, and then nothing will happen. These are sophisticated folks. They can look at a calendar. I for one, don't want to wait. Now that I know more about how this is done, I have less confidence that anything is going to be done unless we start putting the wheels of motion of government into motion to try to, lobby harder on behalf of our residents against, you know, the most powerful company in the state to try to get some better clarity and transparency into how these decisions are made, where Miami Beach stacks up, if it even makes sense, and then try to do our part to try to get us, you know, somewhere in the queue to, further harden our city. Because every time there's a storm, they just reshuffle the deck and redo the data, and we really have no control over it. So
if I can
I'd like to try to even the playing field a little bit and get some real expertise from, engineering groups that that do this for a living.
If I can just jump in there, because you brought up a point that I meant to address earlier when Joe spoke about Stantec as well. Stantec had no influence on the process on selecting any project or lines in Coral Gables. I just want to make that crystal clear, right? I would think they would say the same thing, right? Like Joe mentioned, they were brought in to explore overhead to underground conversion program or project for a citywide conversion years ago, and then they were retained through the city, you know, to stay on board through our program as we were working on this project. But there was no influence, there was no changes made to the program, nor is there an ability for them to do so. Right, this is something that we work with directly with the PSC, for the selection of these projects.
So then you shouldn't have any objection to us doing this?
To doing what?
To engaging Stantec to help us with this.
Well, that's a decision that the city has to make. I just want to make it crystal clear from our point of view that there's no opportunity for them to influence our process, nor have they influenced the process in the past.
So then you shouldn't care if we do this.
Yeah, and
again,
they may
it's a decision of the city.
I take you at your word that they're not influencing the process, but they are engaged in discussions with you, so they can understand all these things that we're trying to understand today in terms of the ranking and so forth.
Well, they're engaged in discussions because the city of Coral Gables has them on staff, right? But it's not a requirement. It's not because, you know, we have to have them involved in the project. That's really a decision that the city made. But again, in terms of what we were talking about earlier, selection of the projects, there was no influence by Stantec in terms of which projects got selected to move forward.
Yeah, I would imagine that to be the case. But I think we're just trying to strengthen our team to help advise us on, you know, some of the data. There's other things I believe that they can do for us, which is to work on maybe getting some federal grants to help offset the costs of this potentially, you know, if and when we ever get in FPNL's queue to, you know, maybe help offset the costs the city might have to bear.
There wouldn't be any costs, though.
Huh?
There would not be any costs.
I hope not, but...
The program is funded, through our rates,
not.
Right?
But there are a lot of things that city has to cover.
The only time that the city would be required to contribute to a project is through that overhead to underground conversion program that I mentioned earlier that has more flexibility, that's really a city-driven process to identify which areas want to be undergrounded, whether it's a feeder, whether it's a lateral, whether it's telephone, internet, cable, any of those.
Okay, good. So do you want to make a motion?
Yeah. I believe that there may be some people on Zoom that wanted to speak, and I think Nick Kalergis can operate that remotely. If not, Stephanie can assist.
Stephanie, okay. Do you want to sit up here? Yeah, because normally I call on Nick to Zoom in and out. So can you control it?
I can control it.
Okay.
Thank
Sorry
you.
About that, guys.
Who do we have in queue?
We have Erica Durst and Joseph Magsy.
Okay, let's go with Erica first. Good morning, Erica. Would you like to talk on this item?
Good morning. Yes. Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yep. Hello. Hi, Erica.
Okay. Hi. I'm a parent, resident of South of Fifth. I'm a parent of children at South Point Elementary. I'm glad you're having this discussion today. I've been dealing with lack of transparency from FPNL for about a year now over the substation that was built on 4th Street that they alluded would be on Alton Road. When I asked why they needed the substation at an unprecedented 70 feet from an elementary school, they said for reliability purposes. They would not answer with any concrete metrics, just vague reliability. We need to increase the reliability in your area. But today I hear we can't get undergrounding because our reliability is too good. So this is another instance where, which is it? I have several more of those, but I'll stay on topic related to the undergrounding issue today. So I just wanted to bring that to your attention. Commissioner Richardson, that was a great question about getting the public records information. I've asked for information from FPL before. They said they could not provide it to me, and then I found it later as public information. So do not always take their word for it. The other thing I was going to say was that, sorry, I lost my train of thought. Just want to thank you again for having this discussion. And if they won't give you where you are in the queue, I do believe that we are entitled to know our performance metrics as it relates in terms of percentage of reliability. How is our city or an area of our city doing in relation to the average FPL customer, whether it be in the state or region? And those metrics should be provided to us, and we can work backwards where we should be in the queue. And also, I hope this, I would like to speak with you commissioners on another time about what that means, this contradiction in reliability information about that substation that has been built with misrepresented information. Thank you.
Thanks, Erica. Okay, next is? Okay, good morning, Joseph.
Good morning, all. Would really like to thank you and applaud the commissioners for really pushing on a very important topic. I, too, am extremely curious why one of the largest economic drivers of the state and also a city that is facing amongst the most challenging resiliency issues in our state is not at the top of the priority list. Be that as it may, what I would ask FPL to consider is essentially working with our city on some of the lower hanging fruit, and by doing so can save taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars. We are facing our own resiliency infrastructure projects where we will be essentially rooting up roads as we prepare to face climate change. And in doing so would present a perfect opportunity to essentially strategically underground some of our overhead utility lines. For instance, along West Avenue, perhaps along First Street, if essentially the roads are ripped up there and raised for in preparation of climate change, that would be a perfect opportunity. The infrastructure is already up. Let's work with FPL to prioritize at least the lower hanging fruit. And if they are unwilling to do that, at least come back in a formal manner and explain exactly why they are unwilling to essentially allow the left hand to work with the right at a cost of hundreds of millions of dollars to taxpayers across all of Florida, why they wouldn't be willing to do that. So again, I really thank and applaud the commission for the time on this. And, you know, unfortunately in situations like this, you got to keep pushing, keep pushing, keep pushing. And I hope that we continue to do so. So thank you.
Is there anyone else?
Nope. We can close public comment.
Yeah. So I make a motion that we keep this here and that we ask Joe to continue coordinating with FPNL and have FPNL come back and do a follow-up presentation. You can get the data, Joe, and get it to us, and then we come back and have a follow-up discussion, whether that's next month or in September.
What about the idea of just formally engaging Stantec to help us with these regulatory matters and help us understand the strategy behind and timing of undergrounding, you know, cable, phone, electric, et cetera, and just serving as our point person on this stuff?
So I would like, I think Joe should have a conversation with them and see what services they can offer and then come back and advise us, Joe, because it may be, it's, you mentioned other things other than just electrical lines, and I think all those things are important.
Yeah, because, I mean, if and when we find ourselves potentially in a position to be in queue, we're going to need someone to guide us, right, to help us understand, you know, where and when things need to be happening. And these folks and similar companies to Stantec, they do this for a living. So, yeah.
So Joe, you said that they're in.
Yes, sir. They're in our consultant.
So why don't, so, you know, even if FPNL's not ready to come back next month and do another follow-up presentation, you could certainly come back in July and at least tell us what services they offer.
Absolutely.
And so we could bring that back in July.
Okay. So we'll keep this item on the agenda for the next.
So I'll show it by acclamation. We're going to continue this to the July 19th Land Use Committee, and Joe will provide a follow-up.
Yep, and hopefully, Joe, you'll have that information on a potential consultant, not just related to electrical, but other things as well.
Right.
And also, hope FPNL is going to get you some data, like,
yes,
forthwith, because it's public
records. I'll work with them.
And then if you guys are ready to come back in July, we'll at least have the list. So we'll either see you back in July or in September. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, guys. Thank you. Okay. All right. Let's maybe do something a little less intense. Item number six, Commissioner Fernandez. This is to expedite the opening of the Bay Walk and move the reopening of the Bay Walk up in the geobond prioritization list and present the Bay Walk plan to this committee. I can't remember when we discussed this last. Was it in this committee or the full commission We had a good conversation recently on this.
Yes, and Mr. Chair, I believe that this committee requested from the administration some information on a specific segment that the administration is ready to present on.
Correct. This, Commissioner Ayerle, you're correct. This was discussed last month. A much broader update was provided last month. There were some more specific questions regarding the Baywalk that is behind the South Gate apartment complex, and the committee asked us to come back with some information. Dave Martinez and I were able to reach out to the new property owners. Dave actually had a very good conversation with the new property owners, and he's going to provide you a brief update now.
That's hopefully good news.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. Yes, as Tom stated, on June 5th, we met with the new ownership of the Southgate Towers. We walked through everything that happened in the past, the development review order, et cetera, et cetera. They asked that we'd give them some time to absorb the information, take a look at it. We explained how important it is to get this opened, and they understand also, obviously, what needs to happen to the South with the South Bay Club being completed. So I guess what I'm saying is we're engaged. They asked us to give them some time to mull it over with their higher-ups, and then come back and talk about what can be done.
Okay. Commissioner Fernandez? So that's with respect to Southgate?
Southgate, okay. Correct.
I want to know, what's the status of the bridge, the pedestrian bridge?
The developer right now is in his final stages of preparing to submit to the Department of Transportation for the formal permit review. This is not the first time the Department of Transportation is involved, but this is the actual formal application. At the same time, they're sorting through some utility conflicts with city utilities at these structural column elements of the bridge in terms of sorting that out to get that straightened out. Other than that, it would be ready for a DOT permit. The idea was to get that permit now through the summer and begin construction at the end of the summer. That was what they were projecting.
All right. Mr. Chair, we've received our update that the committee requests. Let's just keep it here, perhaps bring it back in 3 months for an update, if that's okay with you all.
Let me ask a couple of questions. So part of this is to prioritize. So I want to know do we have what we need to prioritize it? And I don't know if that's Maria Hernandez or it says it's a geo bond and you want to prioritize it. So what would be involved in doing that?
And if I want to just understand your question, Commissioner, prioritize one of the particular, the whole Baywalk in its entirety or one particular segment?
Well, we can ask the sponsor, but it says expedite right. The opening of the Baywalk and move the reopening of the Baywalk up on the geo bond prioritization list. So,
Commissioner, this item has evolved over time. When you look at the memo, actually, the title on the memo is to provide an update regarding the Baywalk along the Southgate Tower. That was the purpose of this update today. This item has evolved over time. I think it was an item that belonged to Commissioner Samuelian. Then I took over the item, and we've kept it here because we want to prioritize the conversations with the different buildings, making sure that there's progress and that staff is on top of this. But I want to also give David the opportunity to chime in on this.
Yes, absolutely, and Commissioner Fernandez is correct. This is a recurring item that comes back approximately every 3 months. At the last meeting we provided a general update, and the committee asked us to bring back the discussion of the Southgate specifically to talk about where they were at in terms of opening since theirs is already constructed. That was the purpose of today's conversation. We are scheduled to come back, Tom, what, in September?
I believe October would be 3 months.
But so from here, the last meeting, it would have been September.
Here's my question, and because we're moving, you know, we've had our first budget workshop, and we're now moving. Last year, the board decided to prioritize capital projects that had funding gaps. One of your priorities was the Bayshore, and we had the one in Sunset Harbor, the parks, right? So what I need to know, because at our next meeting, I'm going to be asking everybody, like, what's your priority, so we all have something that is important to us in the budget. But I need to know if there is a funding gap on anything related to the Baywalk. So maybe for the next budget workshop, which is coming up pretty soon, if you can look at that, because if there's a funding gap and we're trying to get this done, then we're going to need to have a discussion as a board whether or not we want to fund that gap. So that's why I asked the question. So I'm fine to bring this back in the 3 months, but at the next budget workshop, I need to know if there's a funding gap.
And Commissioner, I'll tell you that at some point there will be a funding gap. I don't foresee it for fiscal year 24. We would not be that advanced.
Okay.
We do have the funding available from the general obligation bond for the pedestrian bridge is already funded as part of that developer's agreement through the general. It's about the other three segments that are remaining. There's sufficient funds available to progress those and potentially build one of them. But I don't believe we'll have a shortfall for 24. We won't be that advanced. The permitting on these is extensive, going through all the different regulatory agencies. So just to get to that point. So I foresee probably having funding needs probably for fiscal year 25 potentially, but not for next year.
Okay, that answers my question.
But. Yeah, and well, yeah, go ahead, please.
No. And I like keeping this item in committee because I think it is good for us to get these regular updates. When you all come back in October, I want to hear the progress of whether the anticipated construction for the pedestrian bridge has started. I know that the city has completed, like, for example, for the stretch that goes behind the Mondrian. I know we've completed our obligations with RER and all the different agencies to get the permitting, and now the ball is in the developer's court to start construction. I want to know whether they've started construction when we come back with this update in October. And I know that's also tied with a project over at 500 Alton Road. So I think there's benefit in keeping this item here independent of anything else. And certainly I appreciate David's update here today.
Yeah. It's my opinion. Once the pedestrian bridge is built, this is going to become an even bigger issue in our community. Because let's say the Baywalk was completed now, it would be useful, but mostly useful for people who live north of 5th and mm-hmm. Live along West Avenue. Yep. But once that pedestrian bridge is done, this is going to become a huge issue in our city if the rest of the Baywalk isn't done. So I don't want to find ourselves like flat-footed that once the pedestrian bridge is done, hopefully in the next 2 years, we still haven't, done everything we can to finish the rest of the Baywalk. I mean, I want it all to be almost simultaneously completed. So, guide us, David. If this is a high priority for us, it is for me and I think everybody here.
Yep.
Tell us what we need to do, if it's financial, and we'll start figuring out how to find the money because, otherwise, the residents are really going to be let down if, after all the work we did to get the pedestrian bridge in place, you cross over 5th and then you're, on the Baywalk and you can't even enjoy it. It's just that's going to be a sucky experience for our residents, and I don't want that to happen. I want it to be seamless. Like right around the same time the pedestrian bridge is done, the rest of the Baywalk that's missing is also coming online. That would be wonderful.
Like, for example, I know before we can begin the designs behind some of the buildings, we need to complete our agreements with South Bay Club, with Bay Gardens, with Bayview. Where are we with those agreements? It's to the commissioner's point. If we want to make sure that we have a complete loop, you know, we need to move forward with design, and we can't move forward with design until the city completes its agreement with Bayview, with Bay Gardens, with the South Bay Club. So where are we right now?
Sure. And I believe, Commissioner Dominguez, you have brought this up at the last meeting, which is very important. The largest of those segments is the South Bay Club, and it's the one that will probably give us the initial first big bang for the buck, because it would connect all the way from across the pedestrian bridge through the South Gate at 10th Street. So it's a huge one. So what we're doing right now is we're expanding the services of our consultant that we already have engaged to. We've already have been meeting, as I've reported in previous updates, with all the different property owners. And as you mentioned, Commissioner, you're correct. Each one of the agreements, and in one case, a lack of agreement with one of these properties, has to be amended in some form or another, because the development orders that were given in the past don't necessarily align with what needs to be physically done on the water, just because the easements don't line up. So there's going to have to be some commission action that we're going to have to come back as soon as possible to ratify the necessary agreement, so we have the rights to build these things, these bay walks over water in the locations that we need to. So, yes, we are expanding the agreement, the services to our current consultant, specifically for South Bay Club. That's the largest portion. It's going to be the biggest lift, to include the full design and preparation of construction documents, as well as being engaged with the property owners to be able to bring you back whatever amended agreement needs to come to you for you guys to vote on, so we can move with that one. Simultaneously, we have to engage a separate consultant for the other two, the Bay Garden and Bayview. Those are adjacent to each other. They're smaller, but they're a little more complex. One of them has zero agreement. The other one also has to be modified. We want to work with South Bay first. It's the largest, gives us the biggest bank, and then the plan is 3 or 4 months after that, once that one gets moving, then we'll get working on the other two and then go into permitting. Permitting will take at least a year once we actually submit the official design and everything that's needed. So it's a lot of little moving pieces, but we are taking it forward.
But with South Bay Club, we already are in DRB in South Bay Club, and with Bayview, we're already in, I think there's a planning board development agreement?
Yes. I always forget which. I think it's Bay Garden that does not have an agreement. Correct. Bayview has a planning board, and South Bay has a DRB development order.
And I just had a question. I know that you've updated me several times on this, and you also spoke to our group the last time. This is a very important project. I know it's very complex. It was my understanding that Bay Gardens and Bayview did have agreements, but then the board changed in one of the buildings, and that's where the snag was coming. But I think I'm hearing today that there weren't agreements.
There's an agreement for Bayview,
okay,
not for Bay Garden.
And it's not for Bay Garden because of the new board, or?
I know Tom has a lot of the history on it. The agreements were results of things that occurred over time, that the properties were looking for further development, so it required them to go in front of the boards, which resulted in the boards telling them, you must do these things.
Commissioner, I think that the one that you're talking about where you had a change in the board was Lincoln Bay Tower, where Lincoln Bay agreed in writing, then you had a change of the board. Some of the new board members started to put up obstacles, but I think we resolved Lincoln Bay.
Okay, so that one is resolved.
Bay Garden Manor is the only property that we literally do not have a condition in a development order, because they've never asked for anything. And so that one, as Dave said, is the most challenging, not just from that standpoint, but with regard to the fact that they have a private deck that extends well into the bay.
I see. Well, I do understand that this is very complex and that you're wanting to work on the largest property first. But as the vice mayor said, we want to get this out to the residents. They've been waiting for a very long time, years and years and years. I know Mark started spearheading this years ago, and there's really not been too much progress in opening up the space. So while we're negotiating for South Bay, we really shouldn't leave the other two. We should be negotiating at the same time and work on it so that it could all be open together, because this is so important, and it's an amenity for the community, and it would be really nice for the residents to have that space.
Can I make a suggestion? I mean, I don't want to volunteer you, but, you know, whether it's you, Commissioner Fernandez, or you, Commissioner Dominguez, you know, because Commissioner Richardson and I will term out soon, this is a legacy project for either or both of you to push that final mile, particularly in your case, Commissioner Dominguez, because as you mentioned, our dear former colleague, this is very important to him. It was important to me. I liked working with him on this very much. So I think, you know, if you want to spearhead this, and there's a couple of condominiums, we may just have to go and have some community meetings. I see at least one representative here from WAVNA. I don't know if you're here for this, but, you know, it's a team effort. It's for the benefit of the city and all the residents, particularly those that live in the area. Let's work with the local boards to cooperate and not stall this, because I really want to see this come online sooner rather than later. Once that pedestrian bridge is done, there's no more excuse for delay. If it's money, we'll come up with the money. Permitting is a little bit out of our control, but let's put ourselves in that position where that's the last thing that has to go to get the permits. The money will be there for this.
Yeah, and so to that point, I know you said that you don't think we need anything in 24, but just take another look at it. So if we have, you know, when we have our next budget workshop, if you can give us an idea of what you think might be coming down in 25, you know, I know this is important to all of us. So, you know, let's just take a look at it.
Yeah, we can start earmarking now, depending on what the budget looks like, you know, a little bit now, a little bit next year, and, you know.
And we can do that in that way.
And if there's ever, even though you said, you know, you don't think you need any money in 24, if we were to give you some money, is there any way that any piece of this could be accelerated?
You know, not like the commissioner, because they're all hinging on the permitting, and, again, that takes quite a while, so I don't foresee it coming back in time to spend the money in 24, the additional money in 24. We still have $5 million that we can spend on the first one in construction, and then we will need the additional for construction on the other two.
You know, one thing just popped in my mind, we're talking about money, particularly in this area where there's some development going on. We, you know, with the additional tools that we've, you know, gotten now, or July 1st we'll have from the state with FAR, local developers that want a little bit extra FAR or whatever, this could be the public benefit to fully fund the bay walk and seawall restorations. So just something to keep in the back of our mind in terms of where do we find the money. I think, you know, it's not huge money, but it's enough that you have to, you know, work hard to find it. I think we can be able to find, you know, whatever gaps we have.
This is going to be amazing, and I want to thank those that predate me, including Commissioner Zamullian, because as you well stated, this does complete something very special to be able to cross Fifth Street in a continuous path and then eventually make it to Lincoln Road and reconnect again through Lincoln Road with the beach walk and the 7 miles of it. It really is just sets us apart from every other community. And so happy to partner with Commissioner Dominguez in continuing to work on this. But certainly, to her point, the fact that we're working on with South Bay Club, let's not put aside, you know, the agreement with Bayview, and especially Bay Garden. Clearly, that was going to be the more difficult one. And happy to be of any assistance that may be necessary with those residents. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone online? Do you have any view on this? Come on up. Yeah, I mean, we're talking about your neighborhood, so I wanted to see if maybe you had some thoughts.
WAVNA has been very patient in this whole process, and I know there's a lot involved, David. So, again, I would just like to offer our services from the perspective. I know some of the buildings can be challenging. So, again, we do have relationships with all of them. So wherever we can kind of step in from a community standpoint, because we all are trying to get to the same end goal here. And, again, getting the construction behind the Mirador properties sooner versus later would be great, too. I know that 1000 Mirador, they're kind of doing seawall repair as we speak, but I think that'll be done by this summer. So we can definitely, wherever we can pick up the ball and get the momentum going, would be greatly appreciated. And one other thing to think about, though, as we talk about this whole process, right now we're very segmented and everybody has kind of their gates up and stuff. I hope once this is done, we can take down those gates and have continuous flow just like south of 5th to really make it harmonious. So
thank you. Of course. Thank you. Wonderful. Okay.
We'll show this as continued to the October 25th meeting for the next update.
I think it's too late.
You want to come back in September?
Yeah, I would like to hear, in July, where they are with talking to Bay Gardens and Bayview. So an update on those two and where we are with that. And a follow-up with Southgate after they've had 30 days to absorb the information.
Okay.
All right, so we'll show this as coming back at the July meeting.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Good. I'm glad. Good. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Got a few items left, and they're all sort of related. So if you'll indulge my path to tee this up, we've talked about some of these previously. But, Tom, I'll put you on the spot. I think you're going to take number 10 to discuss the Live Local Act. I think most of us have been briefed, and we've discussed this once, twice. But tell us about this. Do you want to do this, or does Nick want to do this? Nick,
so on the Live Local Act, we had discussed this last month, and we had.
And by the way, does it take effect July 1st, or is it already in effect?
No, it's already in effect.
It's already in effect. Okay.
And we had discussed some of the land use components of it. The committee asked us to take another look at the financial benefits and the potential availability of grants and other funding. We updated the memo to include a summary of that. I believe that either Alba or the Assistant Director for Housing is maybe on Zoom. Oh, they're here. I'm sorry. And she can certainly provide an update on those funding issues.
Hi, good morning. Marcela Rubio, Assistant Director for the Office of Housing and Community Services. The city receives SHIP funds, that's State Housing Initiatives Partnership funds, from the Florida Housing Finance Corporation. And our local housing assistance plan is updated every 3 years to dictate how we utilize these funding. This funding source will cover home ownership assistance programs, which can include down payment with minimal rehabilitation costs, as well as homeowner rehabilitation costs. Every year, the formula for this allocation changes, and this year we're expecting to receive $612,688. How these funds must be broken down, we must allocate 65% of them towards homeownership programs. We must allocate 75% within that allocation towards construction costs. And we also have a statutory requirement to serve low-income and very low-income residents. There is a separate item that we will be bringing to the Mayor and Commission to discuss the award recommendation for the $612,000. But as it stands, in order to meet the program set-asides, we would have approximately $152,000 available for rental housing projects. That's after meeting all the program set-asides.
Questions, comments? Tom, do we have any projects in the works right now? Anyone file with us to take advantage of the Live Local Act yet?
Not yet. There are a number, as we had discussed last month, there are a number of potential zoning incentives for projects that fall within commercial districts or mixed-use districts that include workforce and affordable housing. To date, we haven't seen any applications submitted to take advantage of those, but the act is only a few months old, and so it could be that we may see these in these districts down the line.
Yeah. Are there any that you can think of off the top of your head, you know, projects that are currently, you know, going through the, you know, application or permitting process where we might engage with them to take a look at the Live Local Act and see if maybe they might redo their projects to avail themselves of the benefits of the project, but also to help us achieve more workforce housing? I know I have talked to one or two or three developers just in passing, say, because they're, you know, they're coming to talk to me about projects, and I'm like, have you looked at this, you know? But I don't know, are there any that...
Since the Live Local Act primarily applies to projects that are in commercial districts, it's somewhat limited, at least at this point. For instance, the Housing Authority has a number of workforce and affordable housing projects that are in various stages of the approval and permitting process, but those are in primarily multifamily zoning districts. The one project that is in a commercial district is the Servitas project, but I believe that they're fully completed and almost ready to get a permit. So as of right now, I'm not aware of any that would be considering this, at least at this moment.
Okay. Colleagues, anything on this? I think it behooves us as you know, folks come to us to talk about their projects to have them take a look at this. Well, you know, one project that I'm thinking about is the project on West Avenue that is going through, you know, the micro unit project that's going through the approval process. You know, how might this affect them?
Which project is that? Washington Avenue or West Avenue?
No, Washington Avenue.
Washington. Okay, there's two.
Washington Avenue.
Yeah, there's two. There's one that is just about to get permitted, and it probably wouldn't affect them because I know that they want to move forward and actually start the construction. But there are other project that required a code amendment that the commission approved in the North Washington Avenue area. That potentially could impact that because they actually do contemplate using a certain percentage of workforce and affordable housing, and that is a commercial district. So they would potentially be eligible for this.
Because I'm thinking about in that case where, you know, we have some colleagues that get agita over micro units, right? So if that's going to cause concern, you know, do we encourage them to take a look at the Live Local Act and how that might impact their project so that, you know, they can move forward and they address some of the concerns of folks who may sometimes have issues with micro units.
If they meet the 40% threshold, they very well could consider.
Which most of those micro units ostensibly are about providing workforce housing. So
yeah.
That's where I get this. I'm like, okay, well, if you're really trying to do workforce housing, then just as of right, avail yourself of this legislation, mm-hmm. and you don't have to go through all these, entitlement processes. You could just do it under this act. Anyway, that's why I wanted to have this here, is to try to see what the impact is, and then are there current projects in the pipeline that we might encourage folks to take a look at. I'm just thinking, even our own city projects, I mean, not to get ahead of ourselves, but whatever happens at the Byron Carlisle, you know, could they look at this?
Yeah, they although it's zoned GU, they're surrounded by the TCC district, which is considered commercial, and they would be able to take advantage potentially of this because they would fall within the development regulations for the TCC district.
Yeah. What was the other one I had in mind? I think we're going to be talking about the Barclay at the next commission meeting. I'm not sure. But is that something that could...
The Barclay is zoned RM2. So while they wouldn't be eligible for the Live Local Act, potentially if...
But we could rezone it, do an overlay, or no?
You could either do potentially an overlay for that larger block, or if the proposal to increase FAR for workforce and affordable housing moves forward, then we already have the density bonuses in the comprehensive plan and in the LDRs for workforce and affordable housing. So any increase in FAR could avail themselves of that.
All right, so when that topic comes up, that might be worth, because I mean that's a, we don't have to do anything to the building itself. We just have to figure out the money to do the renovation, right? And then if there's other things we can do, to you know, more maximize the use of that property, you know, whether it's this act or something else. I guess we'll talk about it at the next commission meeting. I think it's on the agenda. Okay. All right. So I guess we can conclude this item for the time being.
Okay. I'll show this as discussed and concluded.
Yeah. Anything else on this topic? Okay. Commissioner Friend has left. He has the Ocean Terrace Overlay LDR amendment. Oh, he's going to come back down for 1, 3, and 4?
Yeah.
Okay.
But he just had to go to the...
How long is he going to be gone? I don't know. Okay. Because I'd like his input. If he's coming back, some of these, I'd like his input. So 1, 3, and 4 will hold off. Tom, do you want to do item 7? This is my item. I'll tee it up. Discuss the identification development of transit-oriented development zones. We've talked about this in the past, which is, you know, even before the recent legislation out of Tallahassee, in trying to identify areas in our city where we want to incentivize development and/or increase density and/or increase FAR, it makes sense to prioritize them around transit-oriented zones so that we can better avail ourselves of mass transit that is potentially going to be brought to our city, not the least of which would be Baylink, which, you know, is now resurfaced in recent months. Going back to Commissioner Samuelin's you know, bus rapid transit program along 41st Street, you know, we're trying to figure out ways to mitigate traffic, improve the quality of life of our residents, increase workforce housing, and all of those intersect with development around what's called transit-oriented development zones. So, Tom, do you want to tell us what you've come up with?
Sure. Rogelio? This actually was one of the things that our consultant for the Resiliency Code recommended that we explore. And when this item was first discussed at the Land Use Committee in January, we went through a very well put together memo by Rogelio from my staff that basically provided a summary of what transit-oriented developments are, and you said it very succinctly, Mr. Chair, they are the types of developments that are geared toward different types of transit. They're not like your typical mixed-use development that just provides a lot of parking and everybody accesses it through parking. These are actually designed around transit corridors. And while they will have a off-street parking component, they will also emphasize other forms of transit, including micro-mobility, bus routes, trolley routes, and if possible, a transit line, so that there is less emphasis put on personal vehicles and more emphasis put on using other forms of mobility and using multiple forms of mobility. These types of developments often are larger than your typical development and larger than what you might be allowed to do within a particular zone. However, the impacts are offset by providing more walkability and putting less emphasis on congestion through automobile. We identified some areas of the city that we believe would be well-suited for transit-oriented development. This includes the Fifth Street corridor between Alton Road and Ocean Drive. Obviously, that is one of the trunk lines for the proposed Baylink project. But also the Alton Road corridor between 4th Street and 9th Street, all the way up to 17th Street, potentially the Washington Avenue corridor. And then other corridors that we could look at would be the 17th Street corridor, in North Beach, the Normandy Drive 71st Street corridor, and even if BRT comes into fruition along the Julia Tuttle Causeway, potentially the 41st Street corridor. So long term, these are different areas of the cities that we've identified. Tangentially, there's another item that pertains to a potential FAR increase for workforce and affordable housing, and we put together a draft ordinance at the direction of the committee that is actually based upon increases in proximity to existing transit corridors and future transit corridors. So there might be a way for these two to merge in some way so that transit-oriented developments have a certain percentage of workforce and affordable housing as part of that component.
Okay, colleagues, anything? So first of all, I just want to say thank you, Tom, and Rogelio and the whole team for putting together or identifying these zones as well as a memo, which we're going to get to. You know, I for one, I agree. I mean, it's these are the obvious areas for, you know, sort of higher density, lower parking requirement type developments. You know, so, you know, we're on the same page. I mean, I think those are the places where it makes the most sense. And then, you know, I think the question for us is, you know, do we want to push for this? Do we want to make this a reality? Do we want to make this a priority or not? I do, but, you know, I need the support of the rest of the commission to have a vision that, you know, along these four or five areas in our city that are mass transit-oriented areas, you know, we're going to allow for certain types of development that we might not allow anywhere else in the city under certain types of conditions. That's the conversation I'd like to be having with my colleagues. Commissioner Dominguez?
Yeah, I just had a couple questions, Vice Mayor. This sounds like very interesting and something that could be very beneficial to the city for sure. And I had a question on when a zone is identified as a TOD. Is that self-identification or is it contingent on a project being approved? How does that specifically work?
Typically what will happen is you would identify areas that would be subject to or could avail themselves of transit-oriented development rights. So, for instance, if the city identified, say, the area along the 5th Street corridor between 4th Street and 6th Street as a TOD overlay, within a TOD overlay ordinance, we would set forth minimum lot size. We would set forth minimum access points. We would set forth maximum FAR in height contingent upon certain benchmarks being made, such as providing workforce and affordable housing, such as providing a certain amount of off-street parking, such as providing a certain amount of mobility components, such as a mobility hub. It could be a covered trolley stop that would serve residents of a larger area. It could be covered bus stops that would allow for better service for regional bus links. It would be something like a micro-mobility hub that would allow for things like e-bikes and e-scooters to be stored and to be utilized by the people that are using it. So it's a very broad type of planning tool, and each community can decide how they want that ordinance to best fit their community. Some areas of the county, for instance, along the Metro Rail line, you may have seen the new developments going up at the Coconut Grove station. They call it Grove Center. The Douglas Road station. Those are very, very large pieces of property where you actually have a major regional rail line coming into the property. So obviously the transit-oriented development that you see there might be different than what we see on Miami Beach, but conceptually it's the same, where it encourages the use of multiple forms of mobility to get around.
Thank you. Great work. Okay. Commissioner Richardson?
I just have, do we know if there's any additional items that are, like, pending in Tallahassee in terms of things that are they're looking at maybe doing to provide incentives, either financial incentives or changes in legislation that would, I guess, require us to do certain things or restrict us to do anything?
Not that I'm aware of as it pertains to transit-oriented development or mandating certain types of development like that. Bradley, are you aware of any? No? I haven't heard of anything. That's not to say that they won't be coming in the next session, but I'm not aware of any at this point.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Anybody online? Okay. So, oh, Tim, come on up.
Thank you. Again, I really appreciate the discussion here and what we're trying to do for our community and to really be smart and responsible in the process. One of the things that I would just warn you about, we've got a lot going on in the city right now. So I think if we chase this too quickly and too rapidly, I think we need to look at things that are really smart and financially responsible right now. And one of those is, first of all, we still have a lot of conversion of smaller properties going to from residential to hotels. If we could stop that process and keep and incentivize people to possibly, and even with the increased bar, if that's what it takes, to convert those back to residential for regular residents, for workforce housing, I think that would be very cost-effective and smart process for us, because that is really a huge issue that's going on right now. Number two, when you bring in a lot of density, although it may be walkability, you still have a lot of service activity with vehicles, Uber Eats, and stuff like that. So I know we've got some big developments, especially right by me, by Park coming in. I think we need to see how these things kind of assimilate in the process before we move forward too aggressively with other upzoning in the area. Regarding the Bay Link, again, we're all about mass transportation. I think it's the way of the future. But again, I think that in particular is a white albatross. That's a very expensive item that's going to be marring our landscape for the future for quite some time, versus going something with bus rapid transit like they're proposing on the Julia Tuttle. That's the type of thing that you can implement right away. It's quick. It's efficient. You can add buses. You can decrease buses during impact areas. But once you build an elevated monorail, you've uglified the area, the neighborhood, and kind of the whole ambiance of what we're trying to create in Miami Beach. And the last thing, too, is to keep in mind, we are a beach area, and we're not a downtown area or an area in the middle of, like, Chicago or something, where we have to really be responsible how we upzone and kind of intensify the area. So I just ask that you keep that in perspective as well. Thank you.
We have Matthew G. online.
Okay. Matt, good morning.
Good morning, Rick. And I want to thank you for bringing this item forward. I think it's really important that we do look at and evaluate the opportunities that we have to build responsibly. That includes engaging in our mass transportation options, including the Bay Link that you did mention. And that is a great opportunity that we have to help alleviate some of the traffic. And I know that there is a workshop coming up on traffic, and I certainly hope that Bay Link is a topic of conversation, because there are real opportunities to help move people from cars onto mass transportation. And Tom mentioned some other items as well, like micromobility and trolleys and buses as well. So thank you so much. And again, I hope that that is further evaluated and perhaps it moves forward, the Bay Link. Thank you.
Yeah, I'll just comment, as someone who grew up, you know, here in South Florida and Dade County, been here now 54 years, and I grew up in the suburbs, and so I've seen, you know, the development of our county as well as our city here in Miami Beach, and like, you know, sometimes I get frustrated and, you know, disheartened, disappointed, you know, when folks start, you know, blasting, you know, mass transit in our city. You know, I've seen what, like, the Metrorail's done for our community. I remember when it was built, and I remember the famous quotes by then President Reagan. You know, and at the time they were well-placed, because, you know, we had built a Metrorail system that at the time didn't have a lot of ridership, but that's because, you know, the downtown area wasn't fully developed. Dade County was still growing, so there's plenty of room to build out. But, you know, over the last 30 years and even the last 20 years, downtown has changed significantly. It's become more of a 24-hour city. It used to be desolate after 5. More people live and work and play in downtown. Most of the development that is now happening in the suburbs in Dade County are around transit-oriented zones. All you have to do is drive down US 1, and you see all of the development that's happening all along the Metro Rail. And that's because traffic is so impossible in our community that people don't want to be in their cars. And if given a choice and an option to have mass transit, they will choose it. And so you start seeing, you know, more and more young people either wanting to live and work, live where they work, such as in downtown Brickell area, or you know, out in the suburbs along the Metro Rail. These things take time, but I do think that to the extent that the county does fulfill its promise to build Baylink, it behooves us to start planning for it. And you know, while right now we may say we don't need it, or there's going to, you know, be, you know, these calamity type events, history has proven the wisdom of having built Metro Rail, because it has allowed for development in downtown and totally converted, you know, the community that I grew up in. And I think, you know, Miami Beach stands in a great place, that if we do this right, this will be an ideal place to live, work, and play, but particularly to live, because you could live here, hop on the Metro Mover that will get you into downtown in 10 minutes, and not have to deal with all the madness of living in Brickell and living in a beach community and not having to get in a car and drive across the causeway. So yeah, I don't want us to get, you know, fooled or bamboozled, you know, when people say this is going to bring, you know, more people to the city or anything. This is going to be a quality of life issue for our residents and for the next generations. And I don't want us to miss this opportunity to do something really intelligent. If and when Baylink comes, I'd like to see us have these transit-oriented zones where people can live near where the mass transit is, so they don't need cars, so that they can improve their quality of life, so that we can have a community that people can, you know, walk, not need cars, and have, you know, all the conveniences of you know, just everyday life near where they live, and not have to have the expense of having a car. So, I don't know. I mean, I've seen it. I've seen what's happened in Dade County, and the folks that live near the mass transit have been the winners. The people that are stuck out in Homestead are the losers. And, you know, they're begging for it now. I mean, they're begging for extensions for mass transit. It's very important, and I don't want us to squander this, because there's folks who come up before us and try to talk us out of it. I think that's the wrong approach, and I think we just have to say, look, we're planning for the future, we're planning for generations to come, and, you know, we want to be part of Baylink, we want to be part of real mass transit options if we're going to be a 21st century city. Okay, so we can conclude this for now, I guess.
So we'll show this as...
So, yeah, thank you. Yeah, let's refer this back for a discussion item at the full commission.
Okay.
But this is going to lead into the memo that you prepared for number 2.
Correct. And perhaps if on item number 2, Rogelio is going to present the ordinance that we drafted, I'll go ahead and introduce the item, Mr. Chair. When this item was discussed at the last meeting, this item's been on the agenda for the last couple of months. The direction given to staff was to think out of the box and prepare an ordinance that would incentivize workforce and affordable housing in terms of FAR increases. And so with a fairly short turnaround, we did put on our planning hats, and we've come up with something that we think is a very good progressive ordinance. Rahelia will take you through it. If there is support for this and this does move to the commission for a referral to the planning board, perhaps we could include a discussion of TODs as part of that referral discussion.
Yeah, I tied both of them together in my mind. To address item 7, the TODs, we'll just refer it for discussion to the full commission.
Okay.
But these are almost companion items in my mind, and I just want to compliment you for putting this together. I've skimmed it. Very impressive, but I was looking forward to the presentation today, so great work.
Thank you. Okay, so as we said, this ordinance merges together the two concepts of transit-oriented development and the need for workforce and affordable housing. So I'll just go through what the ordinance does. So the first thing is it defines what a public transit route is. For our purposes right now, our transit is limited to buses and trolleys, so it defines any route that's operated by Miami-Dade County or the City of Miami Beach or anybody who's contracted to operate transit for those purposes. So we'll look at any bus route that exists in the city, any trolley route that exists in the city for the purposes of the benefits defined in the ordinance. The second thing the ordinance does is it modifies the parking requirements for workforce and affordable housing. Currently, elderly housing has no parking requirements. So if you're doing something that's affordable for the elderly, you have to have no parking. You have no parking requirement. So the first thing this ordinance does is in Tier 1, which is our citywide parking tier, formerly known as Parking District Number 1. It's our largest district. It's where we have the highest parking requirements. It establishes...
Sorry, I know you have some slides in here. Are you going to put anything up?
We don't have a PowerPoint.
I'm just trying to follow the memo, so okay.
I'm going through the ordinance, so if it's in your packet, it should be page 24 of the ordinance. So in Tier 1, which is our citywide parking district where we have the highest parking requirements.
I'm just looking at this map to try to be my guide here.
That's with the FAR. So I'll go ahead and I can skip the parking and go to the FAR.
No,
so
do your thing. I'm trying to visualize what we're talking about, but it's okay.
So citywide, if you have workforce or affordable housing, and if you're located within 500 feet of a public transit route, this ordinance would provide that you have no parking requirement for workforce or affordable housing. Currently, they have a parking requirement of 0.5 spaces per unit. So it is a reduced requirement today. This would reduce it even further if you are within 500 feet of a transit route.
Okay, that's a big, important change. I'm thinking about all of it, but mm-hmm. You guys are recommending that.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. It is expensive to build, and it's only for...
Yeah. I can see Commissioner Dominguez calling you. I'm going to have to digest that myself. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm a big proponent of, you know, smart planning and all of this. I want to talk to you about that. Why do you feel that way? I don't want to blow this, you know. So that sounds like a big change.
It is a major change. So developments would still be providing parking because most of the units in the development would likely be market rate. The parking requirements that apply to market rate housing would continue to apply. So this is only for the workforce and affordable units where we would be removing the parking requirement. The purpose for that is because, as we understand it, it's about $40,000 a space to build a parking spot. And so
my hesitancy, I'm going to interrupt you. Sorry. My hesitancy, I love it. My hesitancy isn't with the idea. My hesitancy is with the mass transit element. Mm-hmm. I don't think we have great mass transit. So great frustration for me as well as everyone who lives in our county. Well, everything you say on this issue makes a lot of sense if we have really good mass transit. If we don't, I'm worried that, you know, people are going to be stuck living mm-hmm. in our city with no parking and not have good, reliable mass transit. But I'm just editorializing for now. I'm not making a decision.
Chair, if I could just add real quick, because we discussed this at length, it's one of the things that's important to point out is that we're not recommending that parking be prohibited. It's basically making it optional. So if a developer wants to provide the parking, they can certainly do so. It will not be an FAR penalty. But we really wanted to remove any potential barriers because in our experience, if somebody wanted to do, say, 100% workforce and affordable housing, oftentimes adding a couple levels of parking can be a cost prohibitive component,
yes.
and that's what we wanted to
yes.
make sure that we address. The other thing that's important to point out is that this would apply to all sizes of development. And so you may have a development on a smaller lot, say two lots or a single lot, that just simply cannot provide elevated levels of parking.
Yes.
And if you have a parking requirement, then oftentimes the number of units are not dictated by unit size or
yes.
density, but by the number of parking spaces that you can provide at the first floor. So we also wanted to take that into consideration. We agree that it is something that takes a lot for people to get their heads around. It's something that is likely going to be controversial, but we did think that from a planning standpoint, it was very important to at least have the discussion and make the recommendation.
Yeah. No, thank you for that, Tom. You know, Rahel, what you said is a fact, right? I mean, to provide parking is expensive. 40,000 is the number I've always used.
Mm-hmm.
So that's embedded in the cost of housing. It raises the cost of housing. So if you can eliminate that, you reduce the cost of housing. Now, the issue will be, and if you have either a place where people can, you know, work and play in addition to live, then they may not need a car. If you've got reliable mass transit, they may not need a car. So it's a bet on the livability of our city, the workability of our city.
Yes. Okay. And the ability for Dade County to...
But it does reduce the cost of housing. Yeah. There's no doubt about it. But
yeah. So I would not support this at all. Our transit is not available to the public to justify the reduction in parking at this time. And what's coming to my mind now is I have a friend who is renting in the Coconut Grove transit area building. And her thought was like, great, I don't need a car. I don't need a parking space, and I can use transit or Uber. Well, the transit in Miami is not taking her to the places where she needs to go, and her Uber is more than if she were to have a car, so she's not going to be able to live there because it didn't make any sense. So that's what's coming to mind. I don't think our transit is there to do this, but it's worth having the discussion.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I mean... It's a fair point, right? It's the big bet. You know, we're not New York City. That's a unique city. You don't need a car, and it's still cost prohibitive to have one. But you can everything you need in New York City is walkable, or you hop on a subway before it became dangerous. But anyway, and maybe the fallback is we try it in an area,
more limited area.
On a pilot, a couple of projects, but okay, keep going.
Okay, so the next thing the ordinance does is in related to parking, in our parking tiers 2 and 3, those are formerly known as parking districts 2 through 9. Those are generally areas where we have centralized parking available. It also does the same thing. It eliminates the parking requirement for workforce and affordable housing in those areas. Currently, what is parking district number, used to be formerly known as parking district number 8 in the North Beach Town Center. There is currently no parking requirement there for workforce and affordable housing, so this would extend that benefit to our other 8 parking districts that we have in the city. As far as FAR, so this is the other big change. It provides for some benefits for FAR. However, there are some areas where the benefits do not apply. These are in our single family areas, that's RS1, 2, 3, and 4, and in our light industrial areas, that's I-1, the I-1 district, which we have in Sunset Harbor and on Terminal Island. We didn't want to include the FAR incentive because those areas have uses where they're generally incompatible with residential uses. So we didn't include it there. We also excluded any area with ROS on the future land use map, that's recreation and open space, so that we would not be able to apply the incentives to our parks. So if the city wanted to use the incentives on city-owned land, the city could, except for those properties that are used for parks. And then also it does not apply within 500 feet of a single-family district. That's in order to make sure that those single-family areas are not impacted by having excessive FAR in their vicinity. So what the ordinance does is if you are within 500 feet of a public transit line, you get a 25% FAR bonus. If you are further away than 500 feet from a public transit line, you get a 15% FAR bonus citywide. So And it does have conditions. So in order to be able to utilize these bonuses...
Trevor Hillier, you're shifting gears. You're moving off of parking, and now you're shifting to...
To FAR. Yeah. So there's, the ordinance has two incentives. The parking is one section, and then FAR is the other.
Let me, before we leave parking, let me just ask a couple of questions about that, because I think, as the chair said, maybe we start in a limited area. So... You know, one of the things I noticed, like in some of the senior buildings, there's not a requirement for parking, but then right now we have staff showing up, right? So they're driving in and out as well. So have we thought about whether or not there should be some limited number of parking, just to the extent that staff, you know, may not be wanting to use public transportation? I think that's something we should at least take a look at.
We didn't look. Senior housing already has no parking requirement. That's an existing code requirement, so we really didn't look at increasing that if it wasn't there today. We would expect that most of those developments have some public parking in their vicinity that those employees could use. So, for example, Rebecca Towers has a public lot nearby where employees could use that. But we really haven't thought about increasing that.
Yeah, like with Rebecca Towers, that's a good example. So most of the spaces are being used by the residents, and there are some spaces that are being used by employees, but there's always a bit of a challenge in terms of where people can park. So the other thing is, I want – this is within 500 feet, right? How do we come up with that number?
So generally, when you have transit-oriented development incentives, they are a quarter mile. When I did a map of a quarter mile, it's basically the whole city with a – one or two lots that aren't within a quarter mile of a public transit route. So we looked at reducing that to something that really made sense, something that was walkable. So 500 feet is about a block or two blocks from a public transit line. And that seemed to make sense, like something that somebody would actually be willing to walk.
I think it probably could be greater, because I think 500 feet is about a tenth of a mile. It's not very much, right? So, I remember, I think our requirement on staying away from an election site with a food distribution was 200 feet, and I think I looked that up, and it was 14 car lengths. So we're talking about roughly 30 car lengths. It's not a lot. I mean, in New York and other places, people walk two or three blocks easily to, you know, a subway stop or something. So we may want to look at increasing that a little bit.
We could certainly consider that. We just felt, you know, there's a hesitancy in South Florida, so we figured we'd start at a number that seemed the most reasonable we could come up with, but definitely people would be willing to walk a little further if they had to.
What is the latest status of the Sixth Street overlay? I know that we had worked on that, and
that is currently pending at the planning board. It came out of the land use committee. It was referred to the planning board by the commission. It's scheduled to be discussed by the planning board at their meeting next month. We've recommended that they transmit it to the commission with a favorable recommendation. At the last couple of meetings, the planning board has wanted to hear more from the Flamingo Park Association, and so that's why they haven't transmitted it as of yet. The sponsor seems okay with the discussion that's been going on at the planning board.
And would what they have right now they're looking at would not include any of this, right?
Correct. This is separate and apart from what's proposed under the Sixth Street overlay.
Because it seems to me that area in particular, if we're looking at a limited area, that area may be the best to start. Whether or not there's a Bay Link, I'm working on the ferry thing as an interim solution, and that would potentially be south of in South Point Park and also in Sunset Harbor. So, yeah. Okay. Go ahead. Then the next piece is FAR, right?
Yes, FAR. So, again, this creates two tiers of incentives. I described the areas where the FAR incentives could not apply. So that's single-family areas, light industrial districts, and within 500 feet of a single-family area, and also on public parks. And so it creates two tiers of FAR incentives. The first one is if you're within 500 feet of a public transit route, you get a 25% FAR bonus. If you are greater than 500 feet of a public transit stop, you get a 15% FAR bonus. And then it has specific criteria which you must meet in order to be eligible for that bonus. The first is that 65% of that bonus FAR be used for actual living space for workforce and affordable housing. So that cannot be used for back of house. It can't be used for hallways, elevators, circulation. It has to be used for living space. We felt that 65% made sense because about 15% is going to be used for back of house, so circulation, hallways. That leaves, so that gets you to 80%. That leaves 20% that the developer can use to make an extra profit and offset the cost of providing those workforce and affordable units. So they can use that 20% for market rate, or if they're in a commercial district for additional commercial uses in order to offset the cost of developing those workforce and affordable units. The second requirement is that the developer is required to seek the review and approval of the Historic Preservation Board or the Design Review Board as applicable. We included this because the Live Local Act has a requirement that any development that is availing themselves of the benefits of the Live Local Act be authorized through administrative approval. So if you're using the Live Local Act, you would only get staff approval. You would not have to go to the board to get approval. So if they want to avail themselves of these FAR benefits, they would have to go to the board so that we can take into account the context and
that's a good pickup.
The third requirement is a covenant prohibiting short-term rentals. So they wouldn't be able to have short-term rentals. That's something we've been doing with other bonuses that we have in the city. And then the last requirement is unit access, that all the workforce and the affordable units have the same access point. We've heard stories of some developments that have mixed incomes where they create a back door for the affordable units and they don't have access to the beauty of the building. We want to avoid that. Everybody should have dignity and have the same entrance. So those are the requirements that we included in the ordinance for the FAR benefits. So that's it.
And just to be clear, these would be tied to the TODs, the 500 feet within mass transit? The distinction I caught myself. So they don't have to be in a TOD, but correct, they still have to be within 500 feet of mass transit. Right.
You have to be within 500 feet to get the greater bonus, the 25%. Yeah. Outside of that area, you can get 15% FAR bonus.
How'd you come up with the 25 and 15%?
The 25%, we did some math. There's a table in the presentation. Roughly equals to about 17 to 25% of the units will be affordable or workforce, assuming they develop at the smallest room. We didn't want to create we've looked at other ordinances, and they say that 20% of the units need to be workforce or affordable. We didn't want to do that because we felt that would force them to make them as small as possible. We wanted there to be some flexibility in case they wanted to have larger units for larger families. So we set it a minimum area that had to be workforce or affordable so that there would be some flexibility in that regard. That's where we came up with that number.
Yeah, where I may have pause on the parking, I'm on the opposite on the FAR. I'm thinking, you know, be a little more aggressive, be a little more generous than 25 and 15% to try to create more workforce housing. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know what the magic threshold, but in my mind, I was thinking at least, these are 25%. Bonuses, right? Okay, because I was thinking 0.25 FAR or 0.5. So it depends on what the
depends
FAR
on your base
is.
FAR,
yeah, because I was thinking at a minimum, you know, 0.5 FAR increase, which is like a happy sort of medium number. But it depends. If you're already in a FAR zone of 3, then, you know, you're talking, what, 0.75.
Correct.
Right, okay.
Correct. Yeah. We felt that it would be better to have a percentage that way in the districts where the FAR was lower. You wouldn't end up with something that was out of scale. The increase would be proportionate to the surrounding community and wouldn't have an overwhelming impact on that surrounding community.
Got it. Yeah, and the new legislation that's come out doesn't The only thing that the legislation, I don't know what it's even called, it's not the Live Local Act, but the one that basically takes away the voter referendum of FAR, doesn't actually prescribe what FAR is. It just gives the power back to the commission to decide.
I can speak to that, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, okay. Yep.
So you're referring to the Senate Bill 718. That was finally transmitted to the governor, and he has 15 days from the date it was transmitted to sign it. So he's not signed it yet, but by my math, he would have by June 29th. What that bill does is it broadly prohibits a local initiative or referendum process in regard to a land development regulation. So it would limit our ability to enforce the referendum requirement in the charter as to future land development regulations. So for instance, the FAR incentives that staff has prepared as part of this item, if the governor signs Senate Bill 718 into law, we could not call a referendum. The commission would be able to approve those on its own.
You got it. Yeah. And the Live Local Act is among other things about density and height, also taking that out of our hands. And then there's a formula that's in the statute as far as, you know, within a mile and blah, blah, blah. But the neither of those statutes address what FAR needs to be. It's significant change, but it doesn't give a developer a new right to FAR. It just changes the process by which FAR is approved. Okay.
Correct. That's right.
Yep.
I have a question, Nick, as well. In the Section 7.1.9.3 floor area ratio incentives, in A and B, it gives a flat bonus of 25% and a flat bonus of 15%. The different neighborhoods of the city, different streets, could be impacted based on whether it's 25 or 15. Is it permitted to put up to 25%, up to 15%, mm-hmm. so that the city staff can make a determination if that area is better to have 20% as opposed to 25%, or to have 10% instead of 15%? Rather than stamping it, you're getting 25 or 15, can we have more latitude using the words up to?
I think the only way we could do that is if there were measurable criteria for what staff would use to make that determination, because I think otherwise you're giving staff sort of a blank check. I mean, up to a certain amount, but I think staff would need criteria.
So it's doable, but we need to do our homework.
One option might be in that regard to, and Nick, I'm just thinking out loud, is, and it might take some modifications to the Design Review Board and Historic Preservation Board criteria, but since these projects would require approval by one of those boards since it's new construction, is to give that authority to that board up to, based upon this criteria. I agree with Nick that unless there's very, very well-defined criteria, everybody would be coming to staff and saying, I need the max, and therefore you have to give me the max, and we really would need some identifiable right. criteria. As part of a land use board, there would be a lot more transparency.
Yeah, so it's a great question, and I had the same concern that I was thinking to do a range, but up to also could, but rather than specific criteria, couldn't we say something like, depending on the character of the neighborhood or something like that, or you're saying we should just let a land use board?
I think that even with a land use board, we'd still need some definable criteria because we're giving a land use board the ability to be able to make kind of a judgment call as to whether or not it should be 15%, 18%, 20%, 25%.
So what would be some examples, like looking at the
the density in the surrounding area, or what would you suggest would be some?
Yeah, we would have to come up with some things, but it could be what the overall height of the surrounding area is, what the built context of the surrounding area is, because it could be you might have a one-block area that's surrounded by, say, a number of non-conforming structures. So a 25% increase didn't make much difference. You might conversely have an area that's an historic district that's all one- and two-story buildings. And a 25% increase, when looked at holistically, might be a little bit too big, and the HPB might need the authority to allow perhaps a little bit less so that that established scale and character and context is preserved.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing forward this item. Just a couple of points. So I see that that under the proposed ordinance, we would provide 25% incentive for workforce housing for developments within 500 feet of a public transit route, a 15% incentive for workforce and affordable housing developments beyond the 500 feet. So my question is this. What is there a limit as to how far away you have to be? So it's 15% beyond the 500 feet, but how far away can you be from public transit?
I don't think we have an outer limit for 15%, correct?
We don't have a limit for the 15%. When we were doing maps, we were originally starting at a quarter mile, which is what's typical when you have these types of incentives, and that covers the whole city with the exception of a couple little dots here and there. So we decided there was really no benefit of including an outer limit because every place is within a quarter mile of a route.
Now, we do have limits on distance from single-family districts.
Mm-hmm.
These incentives would not apply to single-family districts because single-family districts use unit size, and right now that's basically just one dwelling. But we did put in a provision that these benefits could not be utilized if you're within 500 feet of a single-family district because we didn't want to have very large, overwhelming projects immediately abutting or in close proximity to single-family districts. So that was one controlling mechanism that we had proposed.
I think one of the things we should be mindful of is that when we say that we're providing these FAR incentives within a certain distance of public transit routes, they also overlap with a lot of our historic districts. And perhaps we should consider working into this some sort within the percentages that are being proposed here, but some sort of incentive for the retention of the existing contributing building. Because we don't want for the development of workforce housing now to be the threat towards some of our historic assets, that to make progress in historic preservation, then now we have to do away with the old in order to build workforce or affordable housing. So if we're saying, okay, you can have up to 25% of workforce housing for developments within 500 feet of a public transit route, required, let's say, in order to get the full 25%, you need to, you know, retain the existing building or putting some sort of incentive and threshold there so that this doesn't become a threat. I think also as you move farther away from a public transit route, I think, you know, one of the things I saw in the ordinance was that we are eliminating the parking requirements. I do think that sometimes not having parking available does make us more of a challenging place for our workforce to live here. And I think as you get farther away from a public transportation route, I think perhaps have some sort of minimum parking requirement, because I do think lack of availability in parking does put an onus on individuals who can't afford to live here, in part because of that. So just something to keep in mind.
No callers.
So let me ask back. You said that more than 500 feet would include everything in the city in terms of a transit route?
About a quarter mile would include pretty much everything in the city.
You're talking about like a bus route, anything routes. And everything?
Yeah.
So
bus or trolley?
Within a quarter of a mile. Every place in the city is within a quarter of a mile of a...
Every non-single family place, yes. Mm-hmm. Maybe one third of a block in the very center of Flamingo Park is not.
Huh.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I would believe that between our trolleys and buses, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I think one of the things, not all routes are main routes. You know, you have routes that provide different service. And I think that that's one of the things that we need to keep in mind as well. So you want to make sure, from my perspective, okay, if you're doing this, you want to make sure it's not just any route. Because a trolley route that gets you to Publix is not going to be the route that gets you to your place of work. So I think we need to not just make it any transit route. I think it has to be, you know, certain prioritized transit routes because they provide the main service in the city, and we need to identify those. So it'll be great to see them on a map, you know, the different routes that we have, which ones are the main routes and which ones are the more localized routes. Certainly, I think there are certain main routes where this makes more sense for, but if it's just a trolley that gets you, I don't know, to the pharmacy or to somewhere, and it's considered public transportation, but it's not a main form of public transportation, then, you know, we should take that into consideration.
We could look at refining that definition. Right now, we include all public transit routes. But we could, for example, define it where public transit routes that take you outside of the city limits, so that would be the major routes operated by Miami-Dade Transit that get you to downtown or get you to other places of employment outside the city.
Well, I want to, on this topic, goes back to item 7, which is transit-oriented development. Like those areas where we know either now or potentially is going to have really robust mass transit, so Baylink, 5th Street, you know, the surrounding area, 41st Street, potentially 17th Street, 71st Street, you know, where we know we've got lots of, you know, metro buses and or someday metro rail. That's where you pack in the density and the additional FAR. Hmm. And then some of these other areas tread more lightly.
Okay.
Including, you know, me thinking a lot, I want to digest this a little more, but, you know, I would lean in on reducing the parking requirements in those areas, particularly the ones I just mentioned where there's already a lot of retail, medical clinics, banks, places of worship, all of the things that we all need in our daily lives. You could see potentially having less parking requirements there because you need the need for a car is less. As you move further away from those, you know, little areas, you may need a car. So if we're gonna experiment, I would experiment on the transit-oriented development zones that you've already identified with a lot of these things. That being said, to achieve workforce housing, you know, we got to bring the cost of housing down. So you've got to increase the supply. So FAR is part of that equation for sure. So is parking, but I worry that. We'll just push a problem somewhere else, right? So you've got areas where you have more affordable housing, but there's not sufficient parking. So then, you know, you start pushing parking into residential neighborhoods or into garages that haven't even been built yet. Mm-hmm. Question for you, Rogelio. I see Monica back there. To what extent did your analysis take into account where we already have city-owned garages? And then, to the extent that you did that, I think I heard you say you did, the occupancy of those garages. For example, if they're not full, well, then maybe we could definitely experiment and have less parking requirements for workforce housing because we've got garages that are empty. So, you know, if people need a car, they have a place to park.
So generally, our main infrastructure is located where we have parking tiers 2 and 3, previously known as parking districts 2 through 9. Where we have parking districts, that's where we have major city garages. So Sunset Harbor, Lincoln Road, Collins Park neighborhood has a garage. In North Beach, we're contemplating building one. We have a parking district up there. That one already has the affordable housing benefit because of the North Beach Town Center ordinance. And so we included in the ordinance that there would be no parking requirement for workforce and affordable housing in those areas. To the extent of the occupancy of those garages, we really didn't get into that detail for this analysis, but that's certainly something we can do.
Monica knows those numbers. Mm-hmm. She dreams of those numbers. She could tell us. But I mean, yes, so to the extent that, I mean, look, to the extent that we decide we want to do this kind of stuff, and to the extent that, you know, we want to see more workforce housing and then possibly down the road subsidize it through the building of city-owned garages. And it would be a subsidy, but it would be, you know, a very clear, transparent subsidy. It's like the city will provide parking in city-built garages, but it's worth a purpose of either spurring economic activity during the day in the businesses or you know, offsetting the cost of housing for our residents, which is, you know, a valid public policy. Mm-hmm. All right, so where are we at with this, colleagues? I mean, we can kick this to the full commission for conversation. Do we have a couple of things that we like, things we want to throw out?
I wouldn't be supportive of the parking removal at all, and I would like staff to come back with parameters where we can adjust the FAR, so it's not just the blanket 25 or 15. It could be based on the neighborhood. So if you think that that's something that we can discuss at the full commission, it could be moved to the commission or for next month when they come back with the parameters.
Colleagues.
When did you say that this 6th Street overlay is going to be heard, and is it where is it? Is it planning, or where is it?
So the 6th Street overlay is currently pending at the planning board now. If the planning board transmits it at their meeting next Tuesday, we would bring it to the city commission for first reading in July. If they don't get to it at their meeting next week and they discuss it at their July meeting, mm-hmm. we would bring it to the commission for first reading in September.
Yeah. So Commissioner Dominguez, I share your view on the FAR. I'd like to see what we could do on that with a range or an up to. And on the parking, I could support a reduction in parking, although I want to see whether or not there should be some minimum amount of spaces for staff, that sort of thing. And also, I like this idea of looking at where city parking garages are located now. And so if there's a garage within so many feet, maybe it's the 500 feet, then I would be supportive of eliminating the parking requirement in that case. So maybe we could bring it back in July with those two things and discuss. So with the parking, I'm generally supportive of the reduction or elimination of parking, although there might be a need to have some minimum number of spaces for staff or for visitors. And then the other thing is I would be even more supportive if it's within so many feet of a city parking garage.
Okay.
Because then we have parking available.
And Mr. Chair, and the last thing I would like to ask is, as we're looking at these FAR percentages, as I mentioned earlier, how we could look at them as incentives to retain contributing buildings, because a lot of these 500 feet, or even beyond those 500 feet from transit routes, do overlap with some of our historic districts. So how can we make them incentives for the preservation of these contributing buildings?
Sir, come on up.
Thank you. My name is Doug Mayer. I've been doing affordable housing development in Miami Beach for 30 plus years. I do consulting these days. I have a client who owns a vacant lot just a block and a half down the street on Jefferson at 1709 Jefferson. And they are seriously considering doing workforce housing there. They approached me and asked me to help them with that. So your discussion today about FAR is critically important because you have a density bonus, but you can't take advantage of it because you can't build. You know, they say, oh, you can build another 20 units, but you run out of FAR, so you can't do that. There are three legs to the stool. There is the density. Then you also need the FAR. And then finally, you need height. One of the things that you might consider, I didn't hear any discussion of height. You give the 25% bonus, and I would encourage you to think about possibly increasing that a bit, maybe going to 30, 40%. I lost my train of thought.
I don't mean to interrupt
you. Sure, no, go ahead.
Yeah, everything you're saying is or was true up until the Live Local Act. You know, and I don't know, I'm not sure how familiar you are. It's only a couple months old. And I'll call up our city attorney, Nick Kalergis, back up. Because you're right, because of the density and the height issue, that becomes a constraint for development. But under this new Live Local Act, and I'll, you know, hopefully not totally bastardize the interpretation, basically it overrules local city zoning to say you can avail yourself of whatever density and whatever height if you're going to do what's called Live Local Act, which is, 45%?
40%. Minimum
40% of your development is for workforce housing. Then the only standard that you have to comply with is within 1 mile of your development that you get to avail yourself of the maximum density and the maximum height. So for most development in Miami Beach, that's a big blank envelope.
I am familiar with Live Local Act. I've attended some seminars recently on it. And part of the thing that you're missing is that it only applies to certain zoning districts. So, for example, this is a residential district. So even though a residential district could potentially benefit by providing workforce or affordable housing, we still have to comply with the other. And unfortunately, you're right. Live Local Act doesn't
impact. I forgot about that. And in that case, Tom, in order to do that, we would have to create an overlay, yeah?
Right.
Yeah. So we have a tool to deal with that, right? We would create an overlay. Yeah.
The other thing I would ask you to consider is 500 feet. I had to park here today, and I parked in one of the lots across from the convention center on the other side. I just went on to Google and measured it. It's about 1,500 feet to there, about a quarter mile. It took me 5 minutes to walk here. That is not a burden for somebody in an urban environment. You know, if you talk to urban planners, they will tell you that if you can reach public transit in, you know, a 5-10 minute walk, you're in good shape. So I think 500 feet is probably too limited amount. You should think about, you know, something more. And then the other piece of it, the height, that could be given administratively. If somebody comes in with a set of plans and they're qualified to get the FAR bonus, and all of a sudden they go, well, we need another floor. That could be granted administratively as long as they meet the other guidelines. But think about that because I've been in situations where in the city of Miami where we've gotten bonuses and we're, you know, if you're going to build a five-story building, to go six is not a huge impact on the community. So I would encourage you to think about that as well. Also, I just wanted to thank you. I In particular, Mr. Moody invited me to come here. I was talking with his staff on the phone, and he mentioned this was going to be happening today. And I think it's really important what you're doing here. I've been doing affordable housing for 30 years. I've got a 96-unit project that we're doing in the city of Miami in the Little Haiti area. And we're at, I just checked my numbers, we're at almost $480,000 a unit. This is a building that includes parking. It has a podium design, so we have several layers of parking, 96 units on top of that. And we're approaching $500,000 a unit to build this. And it takes, you know, we've been working on this project for 4+ years in terms of getting funding from the state, getting funding from the city, from the county. We've gone after every subsidy that we could possibly get. And so anything that will help bring down those costs, giving a developer additional FAR, additional height, reduction of parking, all of those things make a big difference, and it's greatly appreciated. And I applaud the city for looking at that. Thank you.
So that's a workforce housing project you're doing?
It is.
And it's
$480,000? Oh, no, the other. It's an affordable housing project.
That's an affordable housing project of $480,000?
Well, they're not paying it.
Yeah.
Basically, we're paying it, and then they're getting reduced rents.
You're buying it down. Yeah,
And we can serve people up to 60% of area median income.
Wow.
And so the rents are, well, I mean, I think the rents are pretty reasonable, given where, you know, the people that we're trying to serve. But, we have to meet the rent requirements that are established by the state, so we don't control that.
Yeah, wow, incredible.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
Let me just – so I think – sir, thank you for your comments. I appreciate that. I think the height probably is a more challenging one just because depending on what the neighborhood is. But I would say, Tom, if it's okay with my colleagues – take a look at that and come back and advise us on that. Maybe there is some way to create a range or an up to of a 10% height increase. But, you know, I think it's...
Perhaps we could tie that into the proposal to, rather than making it an absolute 25% by creating a range, the DRB and HPB would also have some latitude for corresponding height increases that would be commensurate with that percentage increase.
Yeah, exactly. So take a look at that as well and bring that.
And Stephanie indicated we do have one caller on Zoom.
Ready? If we could hear Daniel Giraldo. Caller, you have 2 minutes.
Morning, Daniel.
Hi, good morning, commissioners. I was just listening on the background, and I don't know too much yet about the local and the impacts on it. And I think everyone's trying to understand it a little better. But as far as the project 1709 Jefferson, if I'm not mistaken, is the surface parking lot right next to the Palmview neighborhood. And there was a lot of back and forth with the residents, in particular adjacent owners. And the owners of that property already have approval for a beautiful new building that the HPB even approved. So one concern I have with this new legislation is it going to lead to more speculation? And from listening to this speaker, it sounds like even the planning department's already saying, hey, you could come in and get more. And I would just urge us to really think more holistically as far as master plans and neighborhood impacts before we allow this sort of all these projects in the pipeline to be tabled in hopes of more speculative rights. So please keep that in mind. A lot of work has gone into these projects already, and I think we like to see them move forward. Thank you.
Is there anybody else online? Okay.
A public comment.
Okay, great. Okay, colleagues, so we'll bring this back.
Yeah, we'll come back in July, July 19th. We will update the ordinance based upon the comments and direction that we've received from the committee today. And then we'll move forward from there.
And then,
Could I add one more thing? So, Tom, the other thing is, as the chair mentioned, we may want to look at limited areas. So if you could also come back with some recommendations that if we were to just try something in a pilot program, what one or two areas might you recommend?
And when you say like a pilot, for the whole thing, correct? Not just the parking, but
yes, okay. Yeah, exactly. Okay. So I'm thinking, you know, we've been talking about this 6th Street overlay for a long time, and we know that has bus transit to Miami right now, and there may be something. So that to me is an area that would be ripe for something like this. But I'd love to hear from staff on that.
Yeah, rather than a percentage increase from 500 feet for the entire city, we identify areas much like we identified areas for TODs, and that's where this would apply. Yeah. Okay.
Thanks. Okay, very good. Yeah, this is a good, time flew today. It's 12:30, huh? What's that? Yeah, the FPL did take a long time, but that was important. All right, so I mean, we're going to be back here in less than a month, so
when's the next meeting?
Roll these over.
The next meeting is July 19th. July 19th. So the remaining items on the agenda will just roll over to the July 19th meeting? Okay.
Well, thank you, colleagues. Nice seeing you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.